Mr. Forrest, giving you a summary on two pages.
Yes.
Strict instructions.
Mr. Carr. Whack in the head coming.
Please proceed.
See if I might read verbatim again.
Yes, please.
I provided a statement of evidence for the project site in May 2020 and am familiar with the site and the proposals for its development and rezoning. It is also noted that as a colleague of Fraser Walsh, who attended the hearing in the matter of the SHA, I am familiar with his submittal evidence too. As the Queenstown manager for Ground Consulting Limited, I was responsible for the scoping, reporting and review of the suite of ground investigations undertaken for Universal Developments and LAC Property Trust on lots 1 and 2, DP 343855, and lot 1, DP 541414. Whilst these cover the northern area of the wider subject site, the ground conditions encountered are considered representative of the whole site, given the nature of the geology and its deposition south of the glacial moraines of Hawea Township. GCL's reporting provided commentary and recommendations on the ground conditions, natural hazards, foundations for lightweight buildings, stormwater and effluent disposal management, in cognizance of the proposed residential development of the area. Stormwater studies were mainly concentrated with the identified SHA area of the site. The conclusions from the ground investigations, natural hazard assessment, and stormwater testing were as follows. Ground conditions are anticipated to be very consistent across the wider site, comprising thin topsoil over recent alluvial materials, mantling the late Pleistocene river outwash deposits. These generally comprise dense silty sands and dense sandy gravels. Groundwater is interpreted to be at approximately 12 metres depth, based on ORC data set and knowledge of the area through our investigations. Stormwater assessment has demonstrated that the ground conditions are highly conducive to effective soakage to ground, consistent with highly permeable granular soils. Natural hazard assessment has not identified any form of hazard that will pose a risk to the proposed rezoning of the site. With respect to seismic activity for the area, the risk is no greater than the surrounding areas and can be mitigated through appropriate geotechnical and structural design. With respect to the Gladstone Gap and the mapped overland flow paths from its breach, the information comes from a former works consultancy report dated 1994, which is now archived. I had personal communications with WSP in the Queenstown and Alexander offices only yesterday to confirm that. A summary of the report used in an ORC flood assessment for the Timsfield development states that the probable maximum flood level of Lake Hawea would rise to 350.8 metres, at which point the Gladstone Gap embankment would overtop and form an overland flow path downstream as shown on the ORC and Queenstown Lakes District hazard maps for the area. The western margin of the downstream overland flow path from such an event is shown to be coexistent with the eastern extent of the project site. The Gladstone Gap emergency spillway has been designed for floods greater than the design flood for the Lake Hawea control dam, i.e. that of a 1 in 500 annual exceedance probability. Therefore, the likelihood of the Gladstone Gap spillway being activated is extremely unlikely, and the risk of flooding in the eastern margin of the site within its design life, i.e. 1 in 100 years, is very low. Without sight of the works consultancy report, I cannot comment on the modelling used to determine the overland flow path footprint, but can only assume it is based on topographical data. Nor can I make any quantitative comments on the depth or velocity of floodwaters across the zone that may result from an overtopping event. However, a reasonable assumption to make is that the severity and impact of the overland flow would increase as you moved east from the margin of the currently mapped path and site boundary, i.e. be greatest in the central sections and attenuate towards its western and eastern margins. Therefore, although the risk from flooding is low along the western margin, development is proposed within the currently mapped path, so it would be prudent to recognise the existence of the flood hazard. It would become more determinative of any development if development were to continue further east of the site. In my opinion, the use of the buffer areas within the proposed structure plan provide a logical approach to managing any residual risk at the western margin.
Thank you, Mr. Forrest. We'll talk about flood hazards first. First of all, you talked about ORC flood assessment for Timsfield. Was that a fresh modelling of the PMF, or was it based on the 1994 report?
I can only assume it's based on the 1994 report. The letter is dated October 2005. I believe there is a subsequent dam breach report dated 2007, which was undertaken by OPIS, but again, I can't get hold of it.
Ms. Baker-Galloway is probably aware that I have some awareness of these issues, having acted for Contact when it reconsented the hardware control structure, and I was present when a senior Contact executive told a hearing committee that the PMF had been reassessed as not overtopping the Gladstone Gap, which would support your conclusion that it's very unlikely. Accepting that there are different views around, if the best view is that even the PMF wouldn't overtop it, how much of a constraint is that flood hazard? How frequent, for instance, what's the frequency analysis on a PMF?
So the PMF, I think, is 1 in 500, so if it's not going to top that, then they're likely to decrease it, so it's going to be a 1 in 1,000 or even more event. But we, again, without sight of that modelling, I don't know how much cognizance of perhaps climate change has been taken into account. We are becoming warmer and wetter. Who's to say that lake levels in 20, 30, 40 years' time are very different to what is current? And that may question some of those PMF figures and the likelihood of overtopping.
In terms of seismic hazard, tell me that Hawea Fault and Grandview, sort of 30,000, 22,000, how long ago did the last move?
because of the
should
nature.
We run for the hills right now?
Yeah. No, the it's quite a complicated science, but they don't know is the answer because of the deposition of the gravels across the top. But so you go by the date of the gravels. There's no topographical sign or site of the fault line in terms of topographical relief or a scarp or anything, so it's very difficult to map. There is no deflection in the gravels as far as they can tell, so therefore the last fault movement, which is probably retrained to the bedrock, that there's no topographical expression of it through the gravels, so hence they've dated it to that 22,000 and 30,000. Interestingly, the GNS report of March 2019 has downgraded what was the Northwest Cardrona Fault to the Hawea Fault, and the recurrence level has decreased as a consequence. So in terms of building code and seismic risk, it's considered a very low risk, a hazard not worth really considering in terms of a 1 in 100 year building life.
And lastly, I'm talking about the Alpine Fault. Is that anywhere along the Alpine Fault or in this vicinity? Our movement sometime in the next 50 years, is that anywhere along the Alpine Fault?
Yes, that's anywhere along the Alpine Fault. They can't predict where it will be, but they can, based on the modelling that they've got and the geological history that they have, they can demonstrate what the PGAs, the ground accelerations will be and what those effects will be on the ground in and around this area, and that is sort of long rolling motion as against any abrupt sudden rupture of ground.
I was thinking that my seismically safe residence in Wellington is looking better all the time.
No comment.
Commissioner Hill.
Just one question for me. I haven't delved into the SHA decision in any great depth. How was that dealt with in terms of the hazard slash flooding issue, particularly on that eastern side? I know you went there, but you said you were familiar with it.
Well, the evidence is practically the same as mine because based on the same investigations, so the conclusions were the same.
Right. Can you recall, are there any specific conditions or around anything in particular?
No, my evidence has just expanded a little bit on the Gabsden Gap because it affects south of the SHA.
Mr. Williams might know later.
Yeah, he's just demonstrated it on the plan. If you look at the SHA, it's not.
The SHA is outside of the.
Oh, completely outside?
Yeah.
That's just my
eyes. Some notes.
Okay.
Do
you want to see it?
No. I thought I'd seen it in some of the
evidence. Commissioner
Dawson. So, my question was going to be how far is the SHA? Does the Gladstone Gap go? Well, that does not. So, further south in the site, how far into the site does the sort of eastern margin of the modelling done for
the actual width, I'm not sure, but from the scale, it would be in and around.
More than 15 metres.
Yeah.
So when you say that you think that the when you say that the sort of buffer down that side is a good way of dealing with it, it's not really covering all of the room.
The modelling has demonstrated that if the Gabsden Gap were to be breached, then the floodwaters will cover a certain area, and that's shown on the ORC and the QRDC. It's very difficult to predict where and how quickly and how deep those waters will be across that footprint. It will depend on the topography, it will depend on the velocity of the water coming across the gap. And so the fluid dynamics take over, and it could push it to the west side quite easily, just as much as it could push it to the east. Or
just because it's on the margins of the modelling doesn't mean that's
the probability.
No,
the probability will be that it is a far less dangerous situation on the margins, and it will be concentrated through the centre of that footprint. That's the general fluid dynamics, if you like. But that's not to say that it couldn't. I mean, if you look at a braided river, for example, they change their channels all the time. Sometimes, they could have a major flow down the actual margin of the river channel itself. So this may well be a similar situation. So I think safeguarding it is prudent. And going back to my comments about global change, I mean, it might be a little bit tenuous, but who's to say that having the Gladstone Gap becomes more important for safeguarding the dam and the dam waters and the floodwaters. So severance of it, I think, is perhaps a little. I think it's prudent to maintain that facility to release floodwaters.
So, are you saying though that this 15-metre-wide buffer area is sufficient to safeguard
would, I mean, I can't answer that question absolutely, because that would require some detailed modelling of the floodwaters itself and various scenarios put in place. And going back to Commissioner Robertson's question, I mean, how when was that last study actually undertaken? And I think it was 2007. I mean, we have the benefit now of far more sophisticated LIDAR and modelling techniques and software. So the answers may well be very different. But in terms of the basic topography, I still think that footprint is appropriate.
The proposed structure plan,
yeah,
from the area.
Yeah, and the footprint shown on the hazard maps as well.
But you're not suggesting that the buffer area be a little mini stop bank or anything. You're just saying it's a no build.
Just a no build. Again, going back to the risk of property damage, I mean, you know, even if it's a 1 in 250 year event, building code still allows for 1 in 100 years, and the chances of significant volumes of water coming through and doing catastrophic damage to property is low.
Thank you very much.
Mr. McLeod?
None from me. Actually, one small technical question. The Gladstone Gap buffer dam has a structure. It's about 2 metres high, and I've often thought that why wait to the lake waters build up to that 2 metres for them to release, and then have 2 metres across the whole of Lake Hawea attempting to get through the gap that's created, rather than just get rid of the, and if it comes up, well, it comes up and it slowly drains away. Just
I'm not party to the actual dam design and the rationale behind the dam design, but as I understand it, it's a safeguard. It's literally a physical plug that can be removed. So I guess it may well be to do with the rate in which waters are rising, perhaps, and if the modelling is suggesting that they don't need to, because waters will stop and not breach and recede, then they don't need to pull the plug, so to speak.
I'm with you. That sort of makes sense.
Yeah.
But it does seem counterintuitive to wait till it gets to a point and then release in a large quantity across the whole of the...
Well, you're releasing a quantity, not the massive quantity, but...
That's fine. That's all from me, thank you.
That's all, thank you.
Thank you. So we'll have Mr. Espy next.
Thank you. I've got a bunch of copies of a summary here.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. There you go.
Thank you. So, in relation to the effects on landscape character, the submission site is considerably less sensitive to landscape change than the vast majority of locations within the rural parts of the district, and is suitable for urban or suburban development, primarily because it's immediately adjacent to an urban area, it is on flat valley floor land that's of limited productive value in a location that accords with traditional settlement patterns. It does not impart classically pastoral or picturesque aesthetics. It's not part of and is well separated from any ONL or ONF. It is not prominent or particularly visually displayed. So regarding the rural character landscapes of the district generally, in my opinion, the above factors place the site as an area of rural character landscape that's of low sensitivity in relation to urban expansion. In relation to a new or expanded area of urban or suburban development, the treatment of its boundaries or edges is important in relation to both visual and landscape character issues. Regarding the proposed relief, the edges of an expanded hawea will be formed by Domain Road, the green buffer, an area of general industrial zone at the south end with a buffer, and the farmland of the Gladstone flood hazard area, again with a buffer strip along it. The relief sought has been amended in that the proposed buffer edge strips have been extended, as we've heard. Additionally, I understand that subdivision is proposed to be at least a restricted discretionary activity with landscaping as a consideration, and specific provisions requiring comprehensive landscape treatment of the BRA areas that form those buffer spaces. As set in my evidence, I consider that these various measures will provide for appropriate edges to an expanded urban area, including the eastern edge that Ms. Gilbert has some concerns about. They will provide for a softer eastern edge than was considered appropriate by the SHA consent, and I've got the number there. Certainly, the character of Hawea Township itself will change in relation to how it is today. It will become a considerably larger town with newly developed urban and suburban areas. In reality, this will happen even in the absence of the proposed relief. The PDP via stages 1 and 3 rezones Hawea to low-density suburban residential, allowing a maximum of one residence per 450 square metres, with an area of large lot residential A as well. Additionally, the special housing area will create a significant new urban area, and the consented street development will create a rural living area south of Cemetery Road. I consider that these changes will alter what Ms. Gilbert describes as a somewhat sleepy identity. This has already happened to a degree through the subdivision development that has occurred over recent years between the Moraine Slope and Cemetery Road, so that's the bit to the north of the site, Timsfield, etc. Obviously, an expanded town brings with it more amenities not related to landscape necessarily, such as trails and reserves, shops, employment, childcare, less reliance on commuting, etc. In terms of broad-scale landscape planning, an urban edge as provided for by the proposed relief will be logical and defensible, considerably more so than the current situation. There will be some effects on views and southern outlook of elevated residential properties within Hawea. However, due to the orientation of these views and the presence of existing development, I consider that visual amenity will be affected to a low to moderate degree in the short term, and this will reduce as the new suburban development matures, particularly street trees. The visual amenity experience of road users will change, and that Cemetery Road will become a suburban road, while Domain Road will be the urban edge. I do not consider that this will bring about an inappropriate visual amenity situation, particularly when we consider the reserve buffer strips and the controls that form part of the proposed relief. Overall, I consider that the site is suitable for urban or suburban expansion, as described in my evidence. While some effects on landscape character and visual amenity are inevitable, I consider that they've been well mitigated, and the location and characteristics of the site mean that these effects will be much less than they would be in many other rural locations within the district.
Mr. Espy, you're obviously listening to the discussion I was having with Ms. Baker Galloway about the NPS. It sounds to me like your evidence would be that, and is, that the kind of changes that would be wrought by the rezoning that's proposed are inherent in the nature of the beast. They're not anything specific to this site. It's just this is what you get if you expand an urban area. Is that a fair assessment, or is it?
Well, yes,
more
I think that's
that?
That's what I was getting at with some of those comments there, and in my main brief of evidence. That's right. This is what you get when you expand an urban area to this degree, and in fact, I think this site has characteristics such that they're less than they would be in many locations if you expanded an urban area to this degree.
Thank you, Commissioner Hill.
No, thank you.
Commissioner Dawson.
Way of
guess maybe what you're asking is, do you want to have a defensible boundary or a boundary that can be expanded beyond
in the future?
Well, I guess that depends. Maybe that's not really for me. That depends on very long-term strategic planning of the district. And, you know, there are questions about how in a district-wide scale do you want to distribute the population of that district. You can let towns just get bigger and bigger and bigger, and that sort of happens inevitably, or you can... Sometimes, of course, towns are restricted by some topographical restraints that they can't get bigger, and then you have to distribute population somewhere else. So it pops up in
Queenstown.
That's right. So, obviously, we're at the same time as thinking about this. We're thinking about places like Luggett and Alberttown and what have you. So, I guess the question of over the life of this district plan. Is this enough supply, and how does that relate to the supply provided in other areas? I don't really know is the short answer.
How much further is it from there to Harley Flat, the Campoon Road?
Oh, well,
as far again,
it's a long way. I'm looking at Appendix 2 of my evidence, which is a sort of a zoom-out map. Harbour Flat is well away to the south of that map. You can see the domain on that map.
Not much further than the domain.
It's not much further than the domain, so it's... I suppose that's right.
I mean, when I'm biking down...
It looks to be about as much again.
It's not as far.
From Cemetery Road to the southern end of the site, as much again. This is the very precise figure in the air. Just approximately.
So Mr. Hocking says it's 1.1 kilometres from the southern boundary to the domain.
Right.
If you want some scale.
So that's the domain here.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the length of the site?
1.2.
1.2. Mm-hmm. So half as much again. Mm-hmm. Sounds pretty good. Or as much again, rather than much again.
Yeah. It's quite a way.
It's quite a way. Yes.
Mr. McLeod?
One for me. From a landscape, your experience, have we ever used productive soils as an edge, a defensible edge?
I can't think of any examples off my head in this district. It certainly does happen in places around Christchurch, for example, I know, where particularly productive areas are kept out of urban expansion, I suppose. Can't think of any in this district. There may be.
But there are examples of it being used elsewhere?
I'm sure there definitely are, yes.
Yep. Thank you. That's it.
Just picking up on that. I'm thinking of Pukekohe, where
good spuds,
but most of the spud land's now got houses on it.
Yeah.
Where, to the extent there was an urban limit, it seems to have grown over the highly productive land, which is what's prompted now discussions of an NPS to guide that precise issue.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it may well be much more of a factor in the future than it has been in the past. I don't know.
Mr. McLeod, any more?
No, sorry, that's me, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Espy, once again.
Thank you.
Will we see you again?
Yes, indeed, you will. You haven't got rid of me yet.
Not trying to.
The gift that keeps giving.
Oh, yes, of course, we're going to see you on Thursday.
Yes, yep.
So
tomorrow, actually.
As commissioners are thinking of Mr. Barr's appendix with the LUC soils, possibly with that question.
Potentially.
So he's got, if you do look at his rebuttal evidence on the very last page, page 40, you can see that all of the site and its immediately adjacent land is all LUC 6, which is not highly productive soil. And then once you get beyond that on either side, there's LUC 3 as the next classification.
That's the amended plan map, is it?
That's the, oh, it's right at the end of Mr. Barr's evidence, page 40, the
yep.
second rebuttal.
Yep, that's
as you go further south from the site, it's not very high quality soil.
It's all, well, it's all I can say is it's all LUC 6,
so
the site and south of the site. Yep.
Irrespective of the
pour,
yeah.
And yeah, fertiliser. Yeah.
If you actually look at the aerial photo, put some water in, fertiliser, and you can grow anything.
Yeah, yeah. But that's not what the NPS is designed to protect.
No, no. I was just more looking at east.
East. Yeah. Right. We have Mr. Copeland next. Mike Copeland. If that's okay.
I'm just thinking, Ms. Baker Galloway,
yes.
Thinking, have a seat, Mr. Copeland. Thanks, Sal at home. You announced NPS FM limits on fertiliser. What's that going to do to that land?
It's hard to tell because I've only announced a summary. Then that's what's frustrating.
Because I'm still trying to figure out what's happening.
Yeah. So no, until we see the words in the actual document, I don't want to speculate really about that.
Well, I thought you'd have some inside knowledge.
I do, but I'm still frustrated because I don't know what the actual words are going to be.
Yeah. Mr. Copeland, you have the floor.
Thank
right,
you.
So I've got some copies.
I think my summary was circulated to you yesterday.
Yeah. Yes. Yep.
Since you have a rather more extensive summary than your predecessors, I wonder if you could summarise your summary for us as you take us through it, rather than read the whole thing.
I'm mindful of the fact that some people think I talk inversely to how I write, but I will try and do that for you, sir. The first couple of paragraphs, I'm just simply introducing myself and say I've done a piece of evidence in chief and also a supplementary statement of evidence in response to your memorandum, and I say in there that in my view the new NPS further underlines my conclusions as compared to the previous NPS UDC. In the first of my, turning to the summary of my evidence in chief, I point out that the RMA seeks to maximise, consistent with maximising competition and economic efficiency, the RMA excludes considerations being given to trade competition effects, and that I consider the relief sought by urban developments will increase the level of competition in residential and industrial land supply markets. With respect to residential housing development, I stress that housing affordability has been experienced in the Queensland area, and they underline that housing development capacity on its own is not equivalent to the supply of land for housing development. I refer to the frictions in the housing and business land markets, such as land owner inertia, land banking, and fragmented land ownership. And that I suggest there's a need to try and encourage greater competition and address the effects of landowner inertia and other frictions in the market. As I've said, the NPS places emphasis not simply on land capacity sufficiency, but also attempts to improve the competitiveness of the market. And as I've already said, I think that's even stronger in the new document. And that I think that the relief sought by universal developments is consistent with a number of the objectives and policies in those documents. I've mentioned the issue of housing affordability. I won't repeat it here because I think it's already been covered by others before me. I'm happy to answer any questions. With respect to the local shopping centre zone, I believe that it will not undermine the existing zone at Hawea, and I point out the reasons why I do not think it will undermine either the Wanaka Town Centre or the Three Parks commercial areas. With respect to industrial development, I have also said that it will, there are benefits such as increased local employment opportunities, greater critical mass for Hawea, enabling the supply of a broader range of services, and it will also introduce further competition in industrial land supply markets and probably imply lower costs for land supply, industrial land supply, as compared to the centres of Wanaka and Queenstown. And as I've said, with respect to residential land supply, I believe the relief sought by universal developments is consistent, with respect to industrial land, is consistent with both the the previous NPS and the new one. And I do not believe that it will give rise to what I call economic externality costs with respect to public utilities. Turning to the responses to Ms. Hampton, if you don't mind, I'll just read this because it's a little bit more detailed. Firstly, residential land supply. At paragraph 4.5 of her rebuttal evidence, Ms. Hampson stated that the NPS UDC specifies that only sufficient capacity to meet 10 years of projected demand plus a margin needs to be zoned in district plans. In my opinion, this underscores that Ms. Hampson is relying on the NPS to set a maximum area to be zoned for residential development, whereas in my opinion, the overall sentiment of the NPS is not about prescribing the maximum amount of land to be zoned for residential and other forms of urban development. I consider that this sentiment is even stronger in the new NPS. The NPS objectives and policies are about improving competitiveness, providing choice, increasing land supply, and addressing housing affordability issues. I have highlighted the NPS policy PC1's use of the term at least in setting the required margins of feasible development capacity over projected demand. At paragraph 4.6 of her rebuttal evidence, Ms. Hampson provides figures showing additional land capacity at Hawea, which she considers will be sufficient to take into account potential for some land banking. The effects of land banking and other frictions in land markets do not lend themselves to accurate quantification. I consider in the absence of economic or non-economic costs, there is economic benefit in enabling greater areas of land to be zoned for residential and other forms of development, especially given the disconnect between zone capacity and land supply highlighted in my evidence in chief. Similarly, at paragraph 4.8 of her evidence, Ms. Hampston argues that universal development submission would lead to a significant increment of urban expansion. However, Ms. Hampston's evidence does not identify what economic costs would be incurred should such an increment in urban expansion occur. My EIC identifies economic benefits from greater population and critical mass for Hawea and discounts a number of potential economic costs. These benefits are in addition to the improvements to the market for the supply of residential land that the relief sought by universal developments would deliver, even if increased capacity was not utilised during the planned period. At paragraphs 4.9 to 4.11 of her rebuttal evidence, Ms. Hampson argues that I overstate the benefits from greater competition that the relief sought by universal developments would bring. The extension of the urban growth boundary, with the extension of the urban growth boundary, universal developments are seeking would make it a more effective competitor in the Hawea land supply and housing market. Also, greater competition is brought about from increasing contestability or potential competition in markets, and it is not necessary for the actual number of competitors to increase. The removal of barriers to entry is key to increasing market contestability, and zoning restrictions are such a barrier to entry. Irrespective of Ms. Hampson's speculation about the sustainability of multiple competing greenfield developments, the benefits from greater contestability will materialise no matter if, and if so when, new competitors enter the market. At paragraphs 4.12 to 4.18 of her evidence, Ms Hampson argues that the establishment and the concerns expressed by the Mayoral Task Force on Housing Affordability address problems in the land supply market for the whole district, and which are not representative of what is occurring in Hawea. In response, I consider the following points are relevant. A. Hawea is part of the whole Queensland Lakes District, and I consider issues of housing affordability and frictions in the residential land supply market are relevant with respect to both the market for the whole district and the Hawea submarket. B. The median house price in Hawea has more than doubled over the period 2013-20. And C. Whilst universal development's consented special housing area and increases in allowable housing densities within the existing Hawea urban area will contribute to meeting the objectives of the Mayoral Task Force on Housing Affordability, I see no reasons as to why additional measures to stimulate residential land supply at Hawea should not also be considered and enabled in the absence of any economic or non-economic costs associated with such measures. Industrial land supply. At paragraph 4.19 of the rebuttal evidence, Ms Hampson relies on the less permissive rules of Wanaka's GIZ notified in stage 3 of the plan as compared to existing ODP industrial zones to prevent non-industrial land uses on land zoned for industrial uses. The point I was making at paragraph 86D of my evidence in chief is that whatever are the initial intentions of such restrictions, over time pressures will arise to remove or lessen such restrictions. Ms Hampson at paragraphs 4.21 and 4.22 of her rebuttal evidence argue that the MPC UDC does not require councils to provide business land of all types in all locations. I certainly do not make such a claim in my evidence in chief. However, I do argue that the MPC is sympathetic to removing barriers to land supply markets so that landowners are able to meet the demands for different types of land in different locations. I consider this is even more the case with the new NPS. In the case of Universal Development's proposed provision of industrial land, this will provide both employment and business growth opportunities in Hawea in exactly the same way as Ms Hampson agrees will be provided by the proposed local shopping centre zone. It will also provide greater choice of GIZ locations for existing and new industrial and service businesses in the wider Wanaka area and further local employment opportunities, which Ms Hampson identifies as economic benefits at paragraph 13 of her 20 March 2020 evidence in support of zoning additional industrial land at Luggett. At paragraphs 4.23 to 4.27 of her rebuttal evidence, Ms Hampson identifies a number of private sector commercial reasons as to why she considers industrial and service activities should be concentrated in Wanaka rather than for some of these activities to be located in Hawea or elsewhere in the Wanaka ward. Should Universal Development's proposed industrial zone be enabled at Hawea, but private sector firms agree with Ms Hampson's assessment of these commercial considerations, then I would expect these firms will locate within industrial zones in Wanaka and not in Hawea. However, there's no need for the council or its consultants to make these judgments for them. Commercial feasibility from a market perspective is best assessed by actual market participants, not by multi-criteria analysis on the feasibility of different locations undertaken by councils or its consultants. Only where externality costs or benefits exist are council-imposed constraints necessary. The only externality benefit from confining industrial development into industrial zones within Wanaka listed in Ms Hampson's paragraph 4.2 are possible agglomeration benefits for other businesses. But even if these are present, generally they also accrue to new industrial developers and therefore will align with unconstrained market participants' location decisions. At her paragraph 4.26, Ms Hampson is critical of my evidence in chief for not commenting on the scale of the proposed GIZ at Hawea and its appropriateness. Ms Hampson expresses concern that it would significantly increase the current zone capacity. However, Ms Hampson does not identify any costs associated with such an increase in capacity being made available. Whilst I can see why other industrial landowners may not wish this to occur, I do not believe it is the council's role to protect their financial interests, and my evidence in chief identifies a number of economic benefits for Hawea and the district as a whole for enabling industrial development to occur at Hawea. Local shopping centre zone. At paragraph 4.3 of her rebuttal evidence, Ms Hampson states that my evidence does not consider the distributional effects of Universal Development's proposed LSCZ on the existing LSCZ. My EIC does cover such distributional impacts and concludes that such impacts will not be significant beyond trade competition effects. In fact, my evidence in chief refers to Ms Hampson's earlier memorandum for council and which reached the same conclusion. Despite reaching the conclusion in her memorandum that there would be no significant distributional impacts beyond trade competition, Ms. Hampson, in her rebuttal evidence, argues for a cap on the overall retail gross floor area to help mitigate the potential for retail distribution effects on the existing LSCZ, including the duration of those effects, and help ensure that convenience retail development is spread between zones in the medium-long term. This apparently is because of an opportunity cost to those residents and visitors that are closest to the existing LSCZ, and for whom their local convenience centre reaches its potential slower than would otherwise have been the case. This is in spite of Ms. Hampson concluding that with the proposed new LSCZ, the community as a whole will be better off, i.e. the benefits to the many will outweigh the cost to the few, and the long-term viability of the existing LSCZ will not necessarily be undermined. I consider such attempts to micromanage retail development at Hawea or anywhere else is completely unwarranted. Developments of retail and other service activities will always have convenience benefits for some and costs for others. For example, surely no one would suggest dictating that a grocery store be placed on every street intersection within an urban area instead of a supermarket at a single central location. Market participants will address consumer convenience among a variety of factors when deciding between alternative locations for new developments. Also, given that both Ms. Hampson and I agree that the proposed new LSCZ will not undermine the role and viability of the Wanaka Town Centre or Three Parks Commercial Centre, I see no reason why a cap of 4,000 square metres GFA should be imposed. Also, I agree with Mr. Williams that one retail activity be permitted up to 1,000 square metres GFA. Ms. Hampson's proposed 400 square metres GFA maximum cap for the single retail activity in the new LSCZ would prevent a small supermarket being developed at Hawea, and this would unnecessarily constrain the local retail offering. Therefore, I support Universal Development's proposal that one retail activity of up to 1,000 square metres GFA be allowed in the new LSCZ.
Thank you, Mr. Copeland. At various points in your summary, you refer to a Hawea housing market or a submarket. One of the issues the new NPS makes relevant is identification of what is the extent of the housing and labour market. Is there a separate housing and labour market for Hawea, or separate and distinct from Wanaka or Luggett or somewhere else?
I don't think so, although I'm not trying to pass the buck, but I think Mr. Hocking referred earlier to people from Wanaka coming to live at Hawea because of the lower prices. I think we're aware there are very few employment opportunities in Hawea for their residents, so they're mostly, well, they're all bar two or three people working in the pub or the local store or local restaurant, local cafe, have to commute into town to work. So I would say Hawea and Wanaka is definitely are in the same market. Commissioner Dawson referred to Albert Town for my little site visit yesterday. I would have thought Albert Town and Hawea are in similar markets. So, you know, there'll be some people who definitely wouldn't want to live in Hawea but would want to live in Wanaka and possibly vice versa. But when you weigh up price versus distance from work versus views and other attributes that people seek, I think you definitely put Hawea and Wanaka in the same market.
And then you move up the chain. Is Wanaka part of the same housing and labour market as Queenstown?
Yeah. Sorry, you're talking to someone from Wellington side. But yeah, but to a lesser extent, I think. There's a much greater connection between Hawea and Wanaka, obviously, just because of the distance. I mean, the further you go. I came over the Crown Range, and perhaps I was speeding, but I would have done it within an hour. So arguably, some people see living in Wanaka and working in Queenstown as being quite acceptable. Whereas, depending on their particular trade-offs, the hassle of commuting and what have you, they may at some other time in the future decide if I'm going to work in Queenstown, I definitely want to live in Queenstown. But affordability comes into it, and other things. So, to a lesser degree, but I would have thought there's some connection. And certainly there's. I live in a suburb, in an area called Raumati Beach, which is 45 minutes by road, non-peak, and an hour and a half to 3 hours, depending on incidents on the roads between Wellington and Kapiti Coast. And 50% of the people in Kapiti commute into Wellington each day. So.
Well, I'm on train.
And I use a train because I'm 65, and it's the most popular train's the 905 because I can use my gold card.
yes, indeed.
And then if I finish a meeting at 4:30, I usually go to the pub for spending $50 and to save $12.50 going on the train after 6.
That sounds like an economically rational choice. Ms. Hampson, draw our attention to social costs. To what extent have you factored social costs in, quantified and or factored the
revenue? I certainly haven't quantified any social costs, and I haven't specifically put social costs under a heading, and normally I exclude myself from other people's disciplines, and there are specialists that look at social costs. However, I'm not sure if I've got a footnote in here, but generally speaking, providing employment, convenience, being able to drop kids off at school, more active use of non-motorised transport starts straying into the area of social costs, I think, perhaps, if you leave that to you to interpret. And certainly the provision of greater employment opportunities, the live-work-play thing, I think the social costs associated with that, and therefore I think the relief universal developments are seeking has a number of social benefits. There's no doubt under that general heading of greater housing affordability from increased supply, there are definitely social benefits for those particular people. And I have referred, although I do pass the buck to Mr. Williams, I think, to the the question of to what extent existing residents who may be wanting change, to what extent that in my evidence, I think somewhere I raised the question about what weight should be given to that. And I would say those particular residents would regard, if I was doing an exercise to do with Cromwell Motorsport Park, when one of the locals stated that everyone wanted Cromwell to be the same as it was 5 minutes after they arrived. And everyone's arrived over a period of 20 years. So I am aware that, and I'm getting older, some people are resistant to change, and I accept that it's social cost by seeing how we change, by becoming larger. But I also, in my evidence, I've talked about greater critical mass, and there are obvious benefits, I think, in having a greater range of services provided locally. You don't have to go in and out to town. I've referred to the possibility of a supermarket, and clearly a supermarket would provide an opportunity for more competitively priced groceries, which we all have to do once or twice, once a week or once a fortnight. A lot of people would still commute in and out for work and would toss up whether they'd use the local supermarket on their way home or supermarkets in town. I guess the big one in my evidence would be related to under that general heading of housing affordability related to increased supply.
The general question about your conclusions about the benefits of greater competition, to what extent will that occur with implementation of the SHA, and put it another way, what are the incremental benefits above and beyond the SHA of of the rezoning that's been proposed?
I think in my evidence I've said that I've suggested that universal developments will be a more effective competitor if they get the relief they're seeking. I referred to, in addition to that, five additional competitors, because that was what I was told when I wrote my evidence in chief. And I sat here today and heard Mr. Hocking say 13 additional competitors. And
you
I leaned
might,
over.
I said 13 in total, so that might be 12.
12, okay. 12 additional, okay. Okay. So you either you recall Mr. Hocking to find out about those other seven, or I suggest you ask Mr. Williams, if you don't mind the Billy Oates rough concept of a bigger, fatter goat coming after me. As I had a wee discussion with Mr. Williams, I understand that Mr. Hocking, the University of Developments, has sold some of the land to some people who may further subdivide, and that's the difference between my five and the 13. But other people can clarify that. So I think that's additional. Is that enough? It's never enough. I sat in the Commerce Commission for 4 years, and you just can't say that, you know, with four petrol companies, we know they can talk to each other, and petrol prices don't always come down and so forth. And have we got enough power companies and all the rest of it? But I think every economist worth his salt, i.e. those that agree with me, would say that the more competitors, the better. Mm-hmm. We'll never get perfect competition, but we'll surely get the benefits of increased competition by having more players in the market.
Mr. Copeland, I asked Mr. Hocking a question about what assurance there is that, putting the SHA aside, mm-hmm. greater zoning would have the benefits that you're suggesting, and he said he pointed firstly to his own track record, mm-hmm. And secondly to the number of separate developers. The question is, well, putting firstly Mr. Hocking's own plan, in the untimely event that he was bowled by a truck tomorrow,
yeah.
and his nearest and dearest would flick off the land. What is there inherent in the proposal that would ensure the benefits, as opposed to the scenario that I painted, which is experience of medium density zoning not being taken up, and larger sections being sold off for standalone buildings? And
well, firstly, without wanting to walk all over my client's case, because I haven't finally been paid yet, but and I don't in any way doubt his word and his previous performance.
Well, I specifically want to make clear that I'm not casting aspersions on his part. I'm saying there's lots of things that can happen between cup and lip.
When I was on the Commerce Commission, we weren't too happy about accepting behavioural undertakings because the Commerce Commission got a behavioural undertaking which was not adhered to. And the then chairman never trusted anybody else that gave a behavioural undertaking, whoever it was. So I can see your dilemma in the absence of those. But I would then look, so what we were looking for was structural, not undertakings, but structural issues. And I say here, more supply, they are the things that I think is income. And you've got, in my view, despite having read the council's assessment of the new national policy statement, I think you've got a document there from the central government which is telling you to remove these barriers. And you're removing barriers for universal developments because it wants to go beyond what it's achieved with its SHA. And as I say, that to me means that it sees itself as a more effective competitor. And then there's the addition of these other people who may or may not come into the market, but if people want to hold on to the properties and let the prices stay up or rise further, then the greater incentive for them to come in. And that's what we call contestability in economics. And so to me, it's those structural things that I say, in the absence of significant economic costs or a reverse sensitivity type thing or something else, which says you shouldn't allow this land to be zoned industrial. So is that either industrial, commercial, or residential? perhaps add, in terms of the behavioural things, then it's beholden upon the council or whatever to subsequently try and tie universal developments to whatever it promises. But that to me is an additional issue, which is, you know, is possible further down the line.
Going to your...
And sorry, just one example of that is that there's phasing and all that. I'm sure Universal's not necessarily offering that now, but that is often, if you don't do phase one, you're not allowed to do phase two and phase three and all that, so carry on. There are various levers, presumably, that could be dreamed up. You really thought that was the only way to get it over the line. But then I'm sure other people will say, well, why is it if being applied to universal developments and nowhere else and the plan to other people, so that you get this unevenness.
In terms of the different of the size of the local shopping centre zone, you said it's 3.5 hectares. How does that compare to the three parks retail zone and the Wanaka town centre?
Oh, look, I'm sorry, I don't have those figures off the top of my head. But I was involved in the North Lake supermarket, so I may have evidence that tells me those sizes.
Well, don't reach for it.
Okay.
Can I ask if you can ascertain the answer you provide Ms. Baker-Galloway,
sure.
And she will
sure.
feed it into the process.
Yep.
So I'm interested in the three park commercial area.
Yep.
The Wanaka Town Centre, and just for a comparison, the Cadrona Valley Road local shopping centre.
Yep.
That.
I mean, I did look up, for a related purpose, the size of the supermarket. So North Lake, they've got 1,250 square metres. For a small supermarket, and I recall at the time, don't quote me on this, but I think people say it's sort of like a Fresh Choice or whatever. So it's a small supermarket. I think the, as I recall, the existing New World supermarket in downtown Wanaka, which is, has been overshopped and 24-hour staff and repacked and so forth, and you can't get a car park, is something around the 2,500, and proposed new supermarket in three parks, we're going to give it something like 4,500 square metres.
Do you know how big the four square at Albert Town is?
No, I don't. No, sorry. No.
And?
But my only point is 1,000 square metres is the bottom end for a supermarket.
At your summary, paragraph 21, the only externality benefits from confining industrial development to Wanaka are possible agglomeration benefits. Bouncing off Commissioner McLeod's questions, thinking about Objective 8 in the NPS and the reference to climate change issues, is that another externality that comes from not separating your industrial areas or like?
I've tried to say in that paragraph is that commercial participants won't go and burn petrol just for the sake of it. So whilst I agree pollutants, road accidents, obviously there are externality benefits associated with road travel, but if it's more sense, if you're going to minimise transport costs and you weighed those up against land costs and whatever else and decided that it's better for you to be in Wanaka, you will stay in Wanaka. But Mr. Hocking referred to earlier about people who are doing building in Hawea, building in Wanaka. Perhaps 60% in Hawea, 40% in Wanaka, the logical place for them to assess is that, and maybe they live in Hawea, they want to have a builder's yard or whatever in Hawea. Presumably one of the factors in that they've weighed up would be minimising transport costs. And certainly the whole concept of, for example, having a local school, which I know is only provision for, is not guaranteed in the relief sought by university developments, but that, you know, the use of non-motorised transport, kids biking to school, and whatever, with greenhouse gas effects would be minimised by provision for that sort of thing.
I think these are tough kids. I think they bike to Hawea Flat anyway.
Okay, well, seven tracks. All weathers. Well, just south of me is a bike track, which I go down, and I can't get over how few kids there are because they, you know, they used to have mum and dad dropping them off, but now maybe South Island kids are tougher. Yeah.
And not only that, but they generally have to, because of the very water race that Mr. Hawkins defined, have to race through a puddle of water to get there. So almost Scottish in that regard.
Exactly.
Apart from the Hessian undercoats on the way.
Commissioner Dawson.
Following on from the Chair's question about about the industrial area, you sort of must have some concerns about position about the inefficiencies of spreading industrial and service activities across the district, and she talks about the benefits of location, placing them near the bigger urban centre of Wanaka, and you dismiss those of sort of as being private sector commercial reasons in the main. So I just wanted you to elaborate on that a bit more. you end up saying the only possible
winding
it is agglomeration.
Okay.
Just let me. As I read what she said, saying, well, there's a bigger population, you can't guarantee that everybody who works in Hawea is going to live in Hawea. I mean, saying, oh, well, we need some tradesmen's yards. I mean, 9.3 hectares is a lot bigger than a few tradesmen's yards.
Mm-hmm.
So, and over time, people are going to move to wherever the employment is, regardless of where they live. Similarly, customers, you can't guarantee that all the customers are going to be in Hawea versus, or the majority of them in Hawea versus over in the bigger centres of Wanaka,
mm-hmm.
out of town, etc. So she's talking about the wider sort of externality benefits of concentrating your industrial areas nearer the bigger population centres.
Well, logically, I think that'll be the outcome. I'd be surprised to find that Hawea grows to be in size to be larger than Wanaka industrial areas, because I believe that commercial participants will assess the very things you've talked about.
So you're not saying that they're not benefits, that you're just saying they're ones that the commercial participants will act on,
yeah.
Without requiring.
But one of the issues.
Restricted zoning.
Sure.
Yeah.
But two things. One is they will look at comparative land prices, and depending on their type of activity and how important land prices vis-a-vis the convenience of being near their customers, being near the largest workforce, the biggest proportion of their workforce is residents and so forth, they'll take those things into consideration. But secondly, I don't think Ms. Hampson or anyone has identified to me a cost for having some land here zoned for industrial activities, and some people might take up that opportunity. No one's told me about reverse sensitivity effects that can't be managed.
But isn't she talking about travel and commuting costs?
Well, I would have thought that the businesses would have regard to, if they are a courier operator and most of their deliveries are in Wanaka, then I'd expect them, they'd put their base there. They wouldn't come out to Hawea and then put up with the extra cost of having to drive to their customers. In terms of their employees, most employers, I think, would have regard to the reliability of a good workforce and so forth. But I just don't see what's wrong with Hawea having a little bit of industrial as well to balance off. And not everyone wants to commute 17, 18 k's a day, and we don't want them to if they don't have to.
And if there's plenty at Wanaka as well.
There's plenty of capacity zoned according to their modelling.
Mm.
The unfortunate thing is the model capacity is not always turned into supply, and prices are not cheap. And she, in her reports, she has said that and that's where in the wee section I did on COVID-19, it's accepted that the Queensland Lakes District has a relatively small industrial base compared to its tourism activities and all the rest of it, compared to other parts of New Zealand.
It's a light industrial base as opposed to a manufacturing or whatever. Okay. Now, could you just explain to me a bit more about what you mean by contestability?
Sure. We used to use the example in the Commerce Commission of Watties canned vegetables and fruit. Watties had about 99% of the market back in the 1990s when I was on the Commerce Commission, right? But the fact was you could import Italian or Australian fruit at about 2 cents slightly higher a can. So Watties were held, even though they had a large share of the market, there was competition in the market because there were no barriers to entry. There's no duty put on tin fruit, and it seemed you could ship the stuff in, albeit with a bit of transport cost, but labour costs in Italy or the tomatoes were cheaper or whatever. So you don't have to have 50 people in the market to have a highly competitive market, so long as there's plenty of contestability, there's low barriers to entry, and if someone is charging monopoly profits or providing bad service, someone can come in straight away. So my predicament in being in Wellington, not being a property developer down here or even living down here, I don't know whether enabling 5 people is going to bring them into the market this year, 5 years hence or whatever. Mr. Hocking may have a better feel for it. But I can say if you enable them to come in, if you remove barriers for those people to come in, then the players in the market, even if those people don't come in, will be held to account much more. That's what economics would suggest.
And that's what you're calling contestability.
Yes.
Your perceived competition.
Exactly. And so the economic theory about contestability is removing barriers to entry. Because if there's barriers to entry, there's low contestability. And I say zoning constraints are an obvious barrier to entry for someone to come in.
Thank you. That's
all
my question.
Mr. Hill?
Just following that, in terms of that general industrial zoning, from an economic perspective, if that zone doesn't work, I presume there are options. But what we were talking before about, you know, whether defensible boundary and whether it should be an industrial zone, what's your experience or your view as an economist on reversibility, for example? So it becomes an industrial zone, it's not particularly successful, but half it's filled up and demand increases for residential.
It's certainly possible because if you go out and look at my evidence, see whether I'm consistent or not. I'd like to think I am. I've recently worked for Fonterra opposing the changing industrial zoning to residential right in front of their Te Rapa factory up in Hamilton. And they didn't want it for reverse sensitivity reasons. Whereas Perry's, who had previously mined a sand quarry there, had stuffed up the land and said they couldn't put industrial buildings on it now, and there was a great demand for residential development and they could make more money out of that, and they tried for an SHA and central government turned them down after the council had said yes, and then they went the RMA way and the council said yes, and it may still be under appeal. Recently Fonterra had a small accident and some pneumonia went out the door or something. I don't know whether that was a wee message to tell them about reverse sensitive effects that go the other way. But there's an example where it has been reversed,
yeah.
Albeit I was actually working for Fonterra opposing it, because in my view there was a very large external cost, and that Fonterra was suggesting it would not enlarge its plant in the future because it found it a very large handicap of having residential land there. But having said that, even in Ms. Hampton's reports and that, she had a figure in there, which I think is in my evidence in chief, about the high percentage of industrial land which had non-industrial activities on it. It's sort of it's the planning by salami approach that you know, as soon as someone with big pockets and a big law firm come along, sometimes things get changed. No matter how strong she's relying on the fence, we've now got stronger rules. Well, I'm just saying the history's told us sometimes those strong rules don't hold fast.
Just going back to housing affordability, I think it's probably clear. You didn't read out your summary, but I just read it. But imposing affordability measures via the plan is likely to be inefficient and administratively complex. I'm assuming, are you saying that in this context, but in a general context? So you think intervening into the market in that way, you're saying is inefficient in an RMA context,
yeah.
Right? Okay.
I know, and Mr. Hocking talked about the cross subsidies and so forth. Generally, economists are, being a bit idealistic, I suppose, but really it should be general taxation that comes on and does the safety nets and what have you. Otherwise, you're handpicking this person to cross subsidise that particular outcome, and you say, well, why shouldn't Joe Bloggs with $6 billion in the bank be funding that?
Genuine. Thank you. Understood that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all.
Commissioner McLeod.
Yep. Thank you for your evidence, Mr. Coburn, and your experience. And thank you for your definition of economic efficiency. A question that leaps out to me is that you mentioned a perfectly competitive market. Mm-hmm. It's fine in theory, but does one ever exist?
No. Well, only in economics 101.
Yeah.
And then we spend all of economics 202 explaining why it never happens in practice.
There you go.
But my point was that if you can move towards that perfection, albeit not ever getting there, by increasing the supply of participants in the market.
So, and just with regard to externalities and moving towards a perfectly competitive market, would you look at, for example, explain the externalities of cleaning up the tailpipe after excessive nitrogen for the plant? Now, obviously, that has to come in as a discussion.
Yep.
So externalities, therefore, can't be excluded from the discussion.
I don't suggest two different things. One's perfect competition. The other's relying totally on the market to solve everything. I'm not suggesting that the external costs and external benefits do appear.
Mm.
And that's why we have the whole planning regime, and I'm not suggesting no rules, let everyone just do whatever they want. But what I do say is, before you go saying people can't do what they want, you show me what the cost is. And I just say, in this particular instance, I haven't seen reverse sensitivity. I think I've seen some people saying change. Well, you have to weigh that up against the benefits, the external benefits of firstly the market working and therefore getting more housing affordability. And there are also a number of other benefits for how we're from greater critical mass, in my view.
And this is a question I asked Mr. Hocking as well. So I feel to ask you is, greater competition will address land banking. Well, has it worked to date? And we've had an increase of competition, slowly but surely. And I'm just wondering, in your economic view.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have good understanding of the new competitors that came in, and maybe Mr. Hocking, with his history of being here and being in the game, can identify why it hasn't worked. All I'd say is economics would generally say the more you got in, the more competition you've got, the greater likelihood you'll stop the excesses of land banking and so forth.
And I'll take you back to some comments you made earlier on in this discussion, and you referred to the petrol industry.
Yeah.
So there were other...
there's four petrol companies. They employ people to go around. They don't even need to meet in dark rooms and smoke-filled rooms and write things on the back of a paper napkin and so forth. They employ people to sit in the car and see when BP puts its price up, and then they ring up each other, and there's a price leader, and they have what we call oligopoly behaviour, a small number of people, and they follow the leader and so forth. So you can't do it just with four or five, but certainly... 8 is better than 4, and 12 is better than 8, and so forth. In addition to land banking, I've also said in there the fragmentation of land ownership and also inertia. So it's all well saying, if I'm living in a house and I've got a nicer section, and you can say, but hey, you can knock down that section, Mr. Copeland, and put in three houses, and if you work it all out, you will sell off two and you'll be better off. I say, yeah, but I've always lived here, and I walk around to my local pub here, and I don't want to be cheek to jowl with the house next door, so I sit on it. So for people to identify capacity, when people the inertia sounds lazy and restless, but it's actually just an expression of taste in some instances. not everyone will subdivide down to their allowable extent. And so therefore, the capacity identified will not become supply.
So you could, and please, this is your area of expertise, not mine, I'm just trying to explore a thought. You could almost point to the fact that if Mr. Hawking was successful with this submission, that would actually lend more to more inertia in terms of the frontage of how we are not wanting to subdivide for exactly those reasons, because it's a place I've always lived, the value's going to go up.
Yeah.
And there's...
Well, it's a consideration, but I mean, it's, you got to factor in your age, and there's also a group of people that, despite their financial wealth, will downsize. As my wife tells me, she's not going to keep mowing the lawns and doing the garden and
the
vacuuming a 400 square metre house, because she's now decided she only wants to vacuum, or I'm meant to help vacuum 100 each or something, a 200 square metre house or whatever. You know, I mean, there's a whole lot of things going on. I'm just saying that the three frictions I've mentioned with the land banking, and I think people agree that's happened, inertia, and I'm just saying that inertia is not necessarily out-and-out laziness, it's just a fact of life. And the third thing is just the fragmentation. And Mr. Hawking's got a big hunk of land here, single thing, and I'm sure he'll tell you, in addition to like the high density where the dough is, also the scale of doing a biggish block must be that much better than doing a wee bit here and a wee bit there and a wee bit there.
And that's all from me, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kaplan.
So I was going to have Andy Carr next. Mr. Carr?
With his whack on the head.
Almost at 4:30 and 3 minutes, Mr. Carr. For some reason, I think you might have set that up deliberately in your bag ago.
No, have you got yours? You use yours.
Yeah.
Yours. Just so you know, you've got exactly what you've got. There you go, Mrs. Home Secretary.
Most of the text explains the graphics, and I thought the most expeditious way forward would be to talk you through the graphics and largely ignore the text.
Good
but
plan.
The text is provided for your records should you wish to review it at a subsequent time. And the reason for the graphics is that when the council officers were talking to you, they highlighted a couple of locations in particular where they were concerned that it wouldn't be possible to have a safe or efficient intersection improvement scheme that would be triggered, if you like, by the Universal Development submission. I'll talk about the upzoning of the council that's talked about in a second, because the same issue arises there. So if I could just take you to the first graphic, follows on from page 7, it's page 8 but it's unnumbered, and the first intersection that I considered was simply the first one that was mentioned by the council officers, and that's the Cemetery Road Domain Road intersection. That's presently a road where the Domain Road has priority and Cemetery Road gives way, but in view of the likely traffic generation, what I have within my evidence is to say, well, it actually makes sense for the Domain Road North to the Cemetery Road movement to have the priority, and for Domain Road South to kind of tee into that. The council officers raised concerns on the safety of that. So the first graphic there shows the existing curve in the state highway within Queenstown.
So are we back to Franklin Road now?
We're back to Franklin Road.
Okay.
Yep. And so the first one just shows an existing aerial photograph of that curve. The second graphic, what I've done is I've just traced over the central median and the line markings. Turn over the page to the one that's got some red markings on it. That's the Cemetery Road Domain Road intersection as it stands at the moment. and the red lines are the property boundaries, and that's at the same scale as the Frankton-Stanley Street intersection. Figure 4, I've simply dragged and dropped the yellow line markings from Frankton Road onto that location. And over the page again, figure 5, what I've done there is I've simply extended the curve radii so that it lines up a little bit better with Domain Road North. And so the purpose of that is really to highlight that the curve of the road, which I assume was the concern of the council officers, is actually exactly the same as what's already in place on the state highway within Queenstown.
And you realise you've picked probably one of the worst intersections on state highway. That's
how do we know that's a good
down
decision?
From the millennium.
Just by the Blue Peaks.
By the Blue
Peaks.
where we always stay.
And if you're on Franklin Road, on...
How do we know that's an okay curve?
Well, firstly, if it wasn't, then NZTA will be doing something about it. But there are two points, one of which is the capacity of an intersection, the other one is the safety of the intersection. Mm-hmm. So if you, having just said I wouldn't read from my evidence, if you go to paragraph 9 of my evidence, I've actually looked at the crash record in that location. There are 7 crashes that are recorded. 4 of them were drunk drivers. One of them was a car where the CV boot failed and it locked up the wheel, and so it slid into a parked car. And the other two crashes were related to drivers emerging from the stub of Frankton Road and turning right. So that's a capacity issue rather than the curve. There's been no traffic crashes associated with a driver misjudging the curve and skidding off the road.
So on figure 4, where the curves disappear off the side of Domain Road.
That's, yeah.
Why isn't that a problem?
Well, the curves, what I've done is I've tried to step you through the process rather than go too far. So within figure 2, what I've got is the curves of Frankton Road just highlighted.
Yeah.
And then literally I've just picked that up and dropped it onto that one without making any changes whatsoever, just to demonstrate that I'm not doing any sort of smoke and mirrors traffic engineering stuff.
Right.
It's really just a drag and drop just to demonstrate that it firstly fits, and that's the reason for figure 5 of deleting off some of those and just kind of making the curve go a little bit further. So it was really just to demonstrate to you that I wasn't making any changes.
But then you did make changes.
For the reason that you've just highlighted of simply saying that it doesn't make sense for the line markings to go off to the side. So what I was trying to demonstrate is that the curve radii at the Frankton Road, Stanley Street intersection are the same or very similar to what would fit within this location.
Even though you had to sort of curve them round a wee bit more at the end of the curve.
But it's the same. But it's the same radius. Oh. Yeah. Cool.
I don't think Mr. Carr is suggesting you drive into the Harvey River.
No. But if the radius had to be tightened up to avoid that, then you're not getting the same
absolutely.
Curve over.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly the point I was trying to show, that the radius is exactly the same. I've just extended it a little
bit further.
Keeps
going around a bit
yeah.
more. Okay. Thank you.
Figure 6 is an intersection in Rangiora, and that's probably a little bit better of an example, albeit not local, because that's essentially what we will be looking at at Cemetery Domain. And I've been through the same process again. So on figure 7, I've actually just provided a photograph of what it looks like in practice. Figure 8, I've traced over the key line markings. Figure 9, I've rotated them over so slightly and then just dropped them into that existing intersection. And so you can see that fits well within the existing land boundaries. Again, I've checked. It's not quite comparable because the traffic flows are different, but there's no crash record of significance at that intersection at Rangiora.
And that would relate whether it was residential or if the general industrial zone, you're looking at more industrial traffic, that would still function as adequately?
Yes. Yes, it would. In fact, if it was wholly residential, it would probably be a little bit easier because one of the reasons why this needs to be looked at is because there will be, I have allowed for some traffic travelling to the industrial area to be going in the morning, whereas in fact all the residential could be coming out. So there's a cross movement in there that wouldn't be there otherwise. If it was entirely residential, everybody would be going out. The second.
So why do you think that you and Mr. Smith have come to different conclusions on that intersection?
Well, I don't know whether Mr. Smith and I have come to different conclusions. I think Mr. Smith's first point was that we hadn't presented any information to show that it could be done, which is the purpose of this. He then highlighted that it wouldn't be possible to have a safe systems approach. Now, I addressed you on that, but the safe systems approach just gives you a number. It doesn't tell you anything. It's engineering interpretation of what that really means. And to be honest, if you were designing a brand new town, you wouldn't build intersections like that because you build them in a different way. But we're talking about an existing roading infrastructure, and it is very common for existing roading infrastructures to get upgraded or repurposed over time and to change. So I think Mr. Smith's point was maybe that you wouldn't build it like that nowadays, and to an extent he's right, but this is existing roading that we are improving. Now, in terms of the next page over, within my evidence in chief, I said that you could fit a 30-metre diameter circle at the Domain Road Capel Avenue intersection. And so figure one there just shows what that circle looks like. And within my evidence, I also said that this would need to be upgraded to a roundabout in due course. Happily, within Wanaka, the two roundabouts are almost exactly the same size, one of which is on figure two, and that's the Anderson Heights roundabout. The other roundabout, you could just take a walk up the road, it's the one at the end of Ardmore Street and Brownston Street. Both of those are 30-metre diameter roundabouts. And so within figure three, I've just shown the 30-metre circle, showing the outside of the roundabout, and two circles in the middle, one of which is the raised island and the other one is the concrete collar that larger vehicles can overrun. And then as with my previous one on figure four, I've just dragged and dropped that to the Domain Road Capel Avenue intersection to show what it would look like as the very basic roundabout geometry. And then figure five, I've just kind of linked that up to the roads as to how the roads would link into that. So I'd stress that these are not designs as such, they're more sort of proof of concept to demonstrate that you can achieve suitable intersection upgrades within the land available without the need for third-party land, which was the other concern that the officers expressed to you, that additional land may be required. It's my contention that additional land is not required to be able to achieve those outcomes.
And again, why do you think that Mr. Smith or Mr. Rossiter said you needed more land?
Well, I suspect it's simply that there hadn't been that assessment of a sketch layout to demonstrate how it could be achieved. Roundabouts nowadays are built very large. That isn't to say you can't build smaller ones, it's just that you have to be a little bit more careful when you do smaller ones. And since there are two 30-metre roundabouts within Wanaka, it would be not unreasonable to have a similar size one within Harwier. But I think it's primarily, and I don't want to put words into their mouths, but I think it's primarily because there hadn't been a demonstration that it could be achieved. So they were perhaps urging caution that it might not be achieved. And they're quite right, if third-party land was definitely required, it would be a material issue for you to consider.
Mr. Dawson, while you're on the go.
was going to ask about your response to the concerns, which you've done now.
I've covered up a couple, but there was one more that
more
Mr. Ross. Well, there was a couple more that Mr. Ross raised that I can dismiss very quickly. I hope not dismiss. That's probably to be too harsh, but deal to quite quickly. Paragraph 26 of my evidence, Mr. Rossiter talked about how there'd been no analysis carried out of the state highway dam road intersection.
Yes.
Talking about how it needs to be lengthened. Fortuitously, the Google Street View image actually shows a vehicle at the end of what would be the queue, completely by accident, but on page 5, and the graphic there shows that the median, it's a little bit dark unfortunately, but the median is sufficiently wide in that location anyway to accommodate the queue.
So this is queues on the state highway going west, I suppose, or north?
This is going north to
waiting
turn right.
Waiting to turn right and across the van.
Correct, yes.
And you're saying that this car here is effectively 7 vehicles back.
The front of that vehicle corresponds to a 50 metre distance from the holding line. And that's the length of the queue that my analysis was forecasting. So you can see that if that vehicle there, which would essentially be the 8th vehicle in the queue,
yes,
can be wholly within the median, then all the vehicles in front of it can be as well.
Yeah.
So there isn't the concern about vehicles blocking the through traffic.
Because this
location.
Is long hatched median.
Correct.
Coming back from the main turning path.
Correct, yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Any other points?
And the final point was the alternative access route that was discussed. I've looked at that in a little bit more detail. There are actually 2 other routes apart from the one that I've assessed. The reason why I assessed the route that I did is because it's the fastest one and drivers will use the fastest route generally. But I've looked at the travel times if you were to use the Camp Hill Road route instead. It's about 3 minutes longer. And there's also another route, which is via Cane Road, which actually brings you out.
Like
yeah, exactly. And driving that way, it takes you about 26 minutes. So it's longer again. But there are 2 alternative routes if the dam was blocked for any particular reason. I've assumed that they're talking about a sort of a crash on the dam or something like that, rather than a major earthquake, which might mean that the dam couldn't be possible. But in those kind of circumstances,
like
there are other
like
things Kemp that are important.
Hill Road or Luggett.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think that though the concern they expressed of highway essentially being accessed only by one road has a particular weight to it.
I'm thinking of being in Wellington both, thinking that if the Hutt Road were blocked, you'd be a lot longer than 26 minutes going up the road and round.
Yes.
Judgeford.
Absolutely. And Queenstown locally, in the event of a big shake, at best all the routes are blocked off, and at worst you have a tsunami as well from the lake. So there are.
It's not called a tsunami, though, is it?
A sesh.
Sesh, that's right.
Sesh,
it is,
yeah. I do remember a friend coming to visit me from Wanaka to Albertown via Cane Road and the dam. Google must have taken them that way.
Oh no.
Yeah.
So they were slightly frustrated.
That was one of the total digression. But that was when the council did the camping site at
Agatha.
Oh, shut up.
So just one more question. One more question.
Yes.
Mr. Barr raises the possibility of some stop-go point whereby some of these roading issues might need to be sorted out, and,
yeah.
And I know that Mr. Williams is going to tell us about a restricted discretionary, but that isn't. And I don't know. Have you and Mr. Williams been conferring?
We have
about
yeah.
the mechanism to ensure that at appropriate times,
yeah.
the upgrades are required to be achieved at whatever intersection, or the contribution to them, or whatever.
Yeah, so we have been liaison.
What's your perspective on that? I mean,
so I've taken advice from Mr. Williams on that, so I'm not going to go too far into it. But essentially,
you've advised him about when it would be necessary.
Well, it's difficult to advise when it's going to be necessary because the council's own proposal for the upzoning of Highway has not undertaken any traffic modelling at all. The approach that they've taken is to see simply say that the roads are sufficiently wide that intersections can be upgraded, and that will be done as and when the demand is there. It would seem unreasonable, I think, in the course of natural justice, to say that universal development should be treated somehow differently to that. And so what I've done is I've had a look at the mechanisms that I think perhaps led to the council's thinking in that regard. And in my view, that's the subdivision trigger, with it being restricted discretionary. So I think perhaps, and I don't want to put words again into the council's collective mouth, but to my mind, it seems a reasonable way forwards to say that these things can be dealt with as and when through the restricted discretionary status of subdivision. And that same principle would then apply to the universal proposal as well, given that roading is one of the matters that is within the council's discretion in that regard.
Is there a distinction that if there are greater demands on the roading network, there is greater need to know when and how the pinch points will be addressed?
I wouldn't say so. I think if you have an increase of 100 vehicles, that the effect is the same whether it's a single 100 lots that are generating one extra vehicle or one lot generating 100 extra vehicles. The size of the lot might be different, but the total number of vehicles is the same, and the effect of those vehicles is the same.
But the point being that, well, at the moment we have an uncertain demand from the upzoning and the notified plan, and we have the demand that you have quantified out of Mr. Hocking's development. The one thing we know for sure is the end result is much greater than the notified plan. I'm not saying one is incremental on the other, because they'll come in at different times, but the end result is a much greater overall traffic demand on the road network.
Yes.
So as I say, does that mean there is a greater need to know when and how that's going to be sorted out?
Well, if I could, I don't necessarily want to pull you back into my primary evidence, but if I just highlight...
If the answer's in your evidence, just point out to me where it is.
That's what I'm just trying to give you. So the answer is sort of in the evidence, but it isn't perhaps explicit. But if I could take you to table 11 of my evidence in chief.
Page?
It is page 19 of my evidence in chief. And you can see within that table that the levels of service at the Domain Road Cemetery Road intersection are pretty good, with the intersection improvement scheme that I described previously. And so there is spare capacity within that to absorb additional growth. And if you just move down to the next page, table 13, for that notional roundabout design that I presented to you previously, we have level of service A on all of the approaches, which is the best available. So that roundabout, again, has spare capacity within it. So whichever triggers the need for the upgrade, whether it's the upzoning of Harweir, whether it's the universal development's proposal, the outcome of those two intersection upgrades provides more capacity than is actually needed for that development in and of itself. And so there's therefore more capacity for the other one. If Universal goes first and upgrades the intersections, then the traffic generated by the council's upzoning can be accommodated. Equally, if the council goes first, something happens to the Universal proposal, then implementing those schemes would mean that the capacity was available for Universal.
just one for me. I'm assuming you haven't, but have you had an opportunity to discuss your proof of concept with Mr. Smith?
No, I haven't.
Do you intend to?
I'll be happy to take the panel's direction on that. I mean, if there's sort of a standard plan change, it will be the sort of thing that I will be kicking my counsel to the left and saying that we should be doing expert works conferencing.
It is a standard plan change, isn't it?
Sorry, I mean, it's a plan change request as opposed to a rezoning request.
Exactly the same.
The only reason I'm asking is because the council will have to write a reply, and if Mr. Smith is going to come back and say the same thing, this is still fraught with issues and this is going to be a problem for us.
Rather than direct conferencing, can I suggest it might be in Universal's interests for you to approach Mr. Smith and discuss it with him, given that he will have the last word?
Noted.
Yep.
Thank you.
What a sort of standard practice.
I think more in the end instead of brevity now. Thank you, Mr. Carr. That was absolutely crystal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carr.
Thank you. So next we have Mr. Waite.
I have about three pages. I'm just going to read it. My evidence is divided into the following sections: a summary of QLDC's initial and rebuttal evidence, and then some further commentary in response to that evidence. A summary of QLD's initial and rebuttal evidence. Richard Powell was of the QLDC's Property and Infrastructure Division. As outlined in Mr. Powell's initial evidence, there is physical infrastructure in place adjacent to the land proposed for rezoning for both water supply and wastewater reticulation. In his initial evidence, Mr. Powell noted the following. In relation to water supply, specific modelling would need to be carried out to determine available capacity in the existing system and or the required upgrades necessary to provide the required levels of service. In relation to wastewater, he commented that there were no known capacity issues in the adjacent reticulation. However, the Harweir wastewater treatment plant was operating at or beyond capacity. To resolve this capacity issue, it is planned to decommission the wastewater treatment plant and construct a pipeline from Harweir to Project Pure. It was stated that the size of the pipeline and the capacity of Project Pure takes into account future growth models for Harweir, including the subject area, and on that basis, he did not oppose the proposal from a wastewater perspective. In relation to stormwater, Mr. Powers stated that there was no stormwater infrastructure in the vicinity, but that on-site disposal of stormwater was considered feasible. In Mr. Powell's subsequent rebuttal evidence, in response to evidence prepared by myself, Mr. Powell makes the following statements in relation to water supply, wastewater disposal and stormwater disposal. In relation to water supply, Mr. Powell accepts, as a matter of fact, that any supply limitations can be managed with additional bores and or increased reservoir capacity. He states that that is not the proposed measures that would impede the serviceability of the proposal, but rather the funding for such upgrades has not been provided for within the long-term plan. In relation to wastewater, Mr. Powell states that the proposed pipeline between the Harweir wastewater treatment plant and Project Pure has been sized to remove capacity issues for the current growth forecasts within Harweir, and that this does not include increased demand that would be generated by the universal rezoning proposal. This is contrary to the position initially stated. With regards to stormwater, his position is as in his initial evidence. I'll move on to some further commentary in relation to this. There appears to be a disparity between Mr. Powell's initial evidence and his rebuttal evidence in relation to the extent of the Hawea future growth model. In order to determine the nature of this disparity, we have made several requests to the QLDC for the design and supporting report for the Hawea to Project Pure pipeline so that design parameters influencing the size of the pipeline can be understood in the context of the rezoning proposal, as well as the proposed upzoning for the Hawea Township. Unfortunately, that report has not yet been made available to us. Regardless of the parameters of the Hawea growth model used, an increase in pipe size or the installation of an additional pipeline to provide for long-term future growth beyond the current zoning would be a prudent approach. Installing additional capacity in the system now would be very much more cost-effective than undertaking an additional installation in the future. The long-term plan identifies items of required council capital expenditure and allocated funding for those items over a specified timeframe. It has been stated that any upgrades to council infrastructure that would be required as a result of the subject land being rezoned have not been provided for in the current LTP. In an effort to identify what alternatives were available to bridge the difference between what was provided for in the LTP and what would be required to service the area of land proposed for rezoning, a meeting with members of the QLDC Property and Infrastructure Division was conducted. The outcome of that meeting was that there were alternatives beyond the LTP that could ensure infrastructure requirements could be met. The primary alternative was by way of a developer's agreement between Universal Developments and the QLDC. Such an agreement would allow both parties to work toward mutually beneficial goals and would outline a binding agreement for the developer-led financing of the required upgrades in return for offsets to future development contributions. There was a clear willingness from the QLDC to work together with Universal Developments to resolve any servicing matters and ultimately resolve this particular issue. It has also been confirmed by the QLDC that programmed upgrades and the capacity of the Hawea reticulated water supply system will be sufficient to supply the demand for the Hawea special housing area. This was confirmed with modelling through the resource consent process. Consequently, the water supply capacity for the SHA component of the rezoning proposal has already been resolved. Although access to the QLDC's Lake Hawea water network model is not publicly available, we have made a request to have modelling for the proposed zoning undertaken, as recommended in Mr. Powell's evidence. Following this, Mr. Powell has commented that there is no capacity in the existing system, rather than providing modelling results or commentary on what upgrades might be necessary or providing clarity on why the modelling, as he initially requested in his evidence, was not run by the QLDC. We have also requested details on the modelling that would have been required to confirm water supply capacity for the township zone to low density residential upzoning that has been proposed in the PEP. Again, this has not been made available. As a summary in short, fundamentally the QLDC accepts that there are no technical obstacles to the provision of required infrastructure to the subject site. QLDC have opposed the proposed rezoning from an infrastructure perspective on the basis of inadequate funding provisions in the LTP. A recent meeting with the QLDC Infrastructure Division identified alternatives for working through the matter of funding and a willingness to do so. It is confirmed that there is adequate water supply to serve the Hawea special housing area component of the proposed rezoning. And finally, repeated requests to the QLDC for information in relation to modelling of the Hawea reticulated water supply and the design parameters of the Hawea to Project Pure wastewater pipeline were predominantly not responded to.
Thank you, Mr. White. Can you tell me, you're saying that there's plan to upgrade or connect to Project Pure
sort out the SHA area. What's the time frame for that upgrade?
I believe in Mr. Powell's evidence, he stated that it was sometime in 2022 that it would be completed.
Sometime
in 2022.
Given that Mr. Hocking's told us that he's hot to trot and basically bulldozers will arrive in January, is there a looming problem between in terms of that time scale?
Yeah. So through the resource consent process for the SHA, there has been proposed and accepted a temporary measure for dealing with wastewater, that being on-site storage and truck transfer until the pipeline comes online.
Based on what's happened in Wellington, I'm sure that'll make Mr. Hocking very popular.
What's happened in Wellington?
Sludge is being transferred to the landfill because of the decrepit infrastructure in Wellington City.
There is an existing example of that currently happening at Hanley Farm, Jack's Point. That's what they had as a temporary measure there as well. So it's sort of a tried and proven temporary measure before the big pipes go in.
Tried. Proven.
Commissioner Hill.
A couple of issues for me. I'm not familiar. Stormwater. Mm-hmm. Given this, the intensity of development, if the entire rezoning is out, is on-site stormwater disposal actually feasible?
So it's all been managed on-site in the SHA proposal. The way it's been managed is we're using a primary system of pipework to convey stormwater to two large reserves, which will have large soakage chambers installed beneath the ground. There's been extensive soakage testing undertaken by GCL to confirm soakage rates and sizing for these soakage chambers. The geology of the area consists mostly of outwash gravels, which have very high infiltration rates. And so, yes, I believe it is feasible.
So the SHA is a portion of the site. So your opinion is, if this whole area was developed the way that the zoning could envisage, on-site stormwater is still acceptable?
Yep, absolutely. Right. Yeah, the SHA... as I said, it's all managed within the site, within the bounds of the site, and ultimately, once it's fully developed, the flow outside of the site would be at pre-development levels, which is a code of practice requirement.
And in terms of the other issues, the request for information, is there any particular reason why it's not been given to you, or have you not got a reason?
I could speculate that perhaps it's not available, hasn't been carried out, or council's been very busy, and despite several requests, it's just...
So they just haven't replied, or they just said they can't make it available?
Oh, we'll go and have a look, I'll talk to such and such, followed up. Oh, no, I haven't,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question?
The meeting that you had with the council, was that after the rebuttal evidence had been received and read, prepared?
Yep.
And did it cover both the wastewater and the water supply? I mean, when you're talking about the having different options such as a developer's agreement and working together, it was both water supply and wastewater.
Two fundamentals, because essentially the stormwater was accepted as being feasible. So it was both of those pieces of infrastructure we're discussing.
Even though they haven't been giving you the information that you'd like to be able to check and re-look at their modelling or the capacity, etc.,
that hasn't indicated a standing in the way of working together in the future through such an agreement.
No, they seemed quite willing and receptive to the idea of engaging with Universal on options for providing the required upgrades.
And the
funding primarily.
Yeah, because I think you agreed it's technically feasible, which
yes.
really just how do we get the funding in the right sort of sequence. And
exactly.
Okay, all right, thank you for that.
Commissioner McLeod?
No questions. Thank you. Just to highlight there is a clear willingness from LDC to work together with Universal Developments to resolve any issues rather than some conspiracy theory that council is not doing the work. Just in defence of council.
Duly noted.
Very good. Thank you. So we've got our last witness, Mr. Williams.
Yeah, negative 2 minutes.
Not too bad.
But the good news is we're not going to walk out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I did hand out attachments as well, didn't I? They were attached. Oh, actually, these have got A3, these are better.
No attachments.
No,
oh, yeah, they are.
But these ones are even bigger and better, so they chop them around and they've got fancy clips.
Oh. So I've got two of those. Do you want one back?
Yeah.
Another fancy clip.
Oh, yeah.
So is this the same but bigger?
Yes, it's the same but
A3
bigger pictures. Yep.
So we can ditch this one?
Yeah.
Okay. What's that? Now I'm good.
So if the text is the same in the two?
Yes, it should be.
Okay, well, I don't.
Should be or is?
It better be.
All right.
It's the version I approved.
Does one of these or other of these show that there was allusion to a potential school site? Is that highlighted on here?
Yes.
Yep.
Yep. Thank you.
Mr. Williams, would you care to read your summary and then take us through the attachments?
So just at paragraph one. In my opinion, the comprehensive rezoning of the site provides for the logical expansion of Hawea in a planned and coordinated manner, and will contribute positively to the township by providing greater opportunities for live, work and play, and therefore a more sustainable community. Hawea is proposed to grow and change, and is underscored by the National Policy Statement, the NPSUD. Opportunities to add significantly to development capacity should be seen as an opportunity given the needs to address housing supply and affordability issues. In the context of this high-level policy direction, addressing these wider goals now has greater importance when considered against potential concern around detraction of amenity values or simply the scale of change itself. Structure plan updates. Did you want me to go through each of those? I think they've been touched on by Ms. Baker Galloway already. But there I just reiterate the changes that we've made and
yeah,
updates.
Yeah, probably just identify the changes.
Yeah. So the first change is extending the 15 metre building restriction area all the way up Domain Road to Cemetery Road. A portion of that was previously shown as 5 metres, and that's in response to Ms. Gilbert's comments in that respect. And then on the eastern boundary, the 15 metre building restriction area has been extended all the way up the boundary to the SHA. Again, that's in response to Ms. Gilbert's comments, noting that the SHA and its consenting has its own subdivision design for that boundary.
So what is along that boundary in the SHA consent?
So the general approach has been that in the subdivision design, because the access is internal, that's the rear yards of those lots, so there's a high proportion of planting and landscaping along that boundary anticipated.
In the lots, so
yes.
Subject to the landowners doing it themselves?
Yes.
Yeah, so there's no public land or strip along
no,
there?
No, there's not.
So there'll be a line of fences along there, more than likely, or?
Not necessarily, no. So I think the deer fence initially is to remain, and that is in consultation with the adjoining farmer. And then over time, the intention is that the landscaping will naturally build along that boundary and soften any concern and concerns of visibility. But that was all very thoroughly traversed in the SHA hearing and the decision.
I totally accept that it was traversed in the SHA and there's no requirement to address that, but it does lead to a bit of a dead end for the BRA and potential. So I was just wondering about the potential benefit. I fully understand why it stops there,
yes.
But just looking at
the
logical
benefit
extension
and
the benefit overall for if we're minded to look at the entire site, if there'd be any benefit in discussion, the similar treatment BRA on that boundary. I'm just throwing it out as opposed to asking a specific question.
Well, in terms of the benefits, the boundary is largely a landscape treatment to the edge, and so the SHA has its own approach to achieve that outcome. Beyond that, in terms of it's really important that the SHA will be implemented, and that we don't want there to be any implication that by showing a building restriction area out there, that's implying that the SHA will no longer be delivered with the number of houses and its associated contributions, etc., to the housing trust.
So, I mean, if there was a 15-metre building restriction area and planting requirement all down that boundary of the SHA, it would start completely mucking up the lots that are already located and the locations of roads and everything.
That's right. Yeah. You'll lose the whole eastern row of lots as a result. So I'm comfortable that together they provide a treatment to that boundary that's appropriate. And then finally, in response to Mr. Barr's suggestion, we've included the primary roading network, as illustrated previously in the indicative master plan. And those roads within the SHA are fixed, and those beyond that are indicative with some ability for them to move through the subdivision process. So that brings me to paragraph 4, infrastructure. A meeting has been held with Kiori staff, including Council Chief Engineer Mr. Ulrich Bresner, on the 15th of July to discuss potential infrastructure options. An outcome of this meeting was confirmation from Council that modelling of water and wastewater was currently going to be completed for Hawea, and the additional capacity associated with this rezoning would be included in the modelling. Mr. Carr's provided further evidence to confirm suitable upgrades to Cemetery Road and Domain Road can be accommodated. Given the growth anticipated in Hawea, irrespective of the rezoning, a number of upgrades of services and roading will occur over time. It is considered this process and provision for growth can also accommodate and provide for the site. It is acknowledged, given the time needed for any upgrades to be resolved, the plan provisions should seek to ensure a mechanism to address infrastructure and roading matters. To this extent, I propose changes to the Chapter 27 rules such that any development within the site, even if in accordance with the structure plan, is a restricted discretionary activity rather than controlled, and the matters of discretion under Rule 27.5.7 would apply. And there's quite an extensive list of matters of discretion, but the key ones relevant to infrastructure and roading are C, property access and roading, G, water supply, and I, sewage treatment and disposal. And then the updated provisions attached to my summary, Appendix B, provide for this change. In my opinion, these matters of discretion, along with the restricted discretionary status, allowing an application to be declined, will ensure adequate scope for any roading upgrades or infrastructure matters to be addressed. No threshold is considered necessary in terms of housing numbers, given the SHAs to be consented and will be implemented by the approved consent. Industrial zoning. I remain of the opinion that providing for industrial zoning at Hawea will positively contribute to the functioning and employment opportunities within the township. In my view, as assessed in my evidence, the proposed zoning finds support in the strategic policies of the plan, and that these policies do not place a particular focus on containing industrial zoning in Wanaka, for example. The MPSUD also underscores this view where greater emphasis is placed on live-work opportunities, Objective 3. In terms of the size of this area, it has been strategically located to provide a southern bookend to the overall zoning and runs the full length of the site boundary. Typically, industrial areas are established on the periphery of urban areas, as is proposed in this case. These factors, along with the desire to create an efficient subdivision layout where the road access through the zone is double-loaded, development on both sides, and a loop rather than a cul-de-sac head, also contribute to the area of zoning proposed. In my opinion, taking into account future subdivision design and roading is important when determining the extent of any zoning. A local shopping centre zone. I support Ms Hampson's recommendation and her rebuttal evidence to provide for one larger retail tenancy, such as a supermarket, to be enabled within the LSCZ. I consider allowing more flexibility in terms of GFA will be beneficial. While any such addition would remain limited to one premise, to ensure such a provision provides the greatest opportunity to be effective, in my view, it would assist if this cap was set more openly. In this respect, I've recommended the cap for this retail tenancy be set at 1,000 rather than 400 square metres, recommended by Ms Hampson. The updated plan provisions attached to my evidence provide for this change. Ms Hampson, in her rebuttal evidence, has recommended a total cap on the retail of 4,000 square metres, which she notes this is to help ensure a functional mix of activities can develop on the site. Mr Copeland, in his summary statement, has detailed why, from an economic perspective, he does not support such a cap. In my opinion, such a cap would also create potential negative urban design outcomes and limiting the ability to ensure ground floor space is occupied by retail activity that more typically can provide an active interface to the street. A cap of the nature proposed is likely to necessitate some ground floor office or other uses. Policy 5.2.1 also identifies that the purpose of the retail and office caps is to avoid floor areas that would adversely affect, and then A, retention and establishment of a mix of activities within the local shopping centre. In my view, as these caps are intended to provide the necessary method to achieve the mix within the LSCZ, no overall cap is necessary. And then the school site. The plan submitted with my evidence identified a school site, and I note Mr Barr has questioned how this is intended to operate within the rural framework. The land where the school has been indicated would be zoned low density suburban residential, and no specific rules are proposed to provide for a school. Rather, it is considered sensible, given the growth occurring in Hawea and where no school is currently located in the township, to look at a potential site. In my experience, even with the ability for the Ministry of Education to designate school sites, if residential properties are established, reverse sensitivity issues in terms of traffic and noise in particular can often still arise and frustrate the designation process. This tension is often largely because residents were not aware of the potential for a school to establish. It is considered helpful to identify a location for these reasons. However, to avoid any confusion in the plan rule framework, the structure plan, Appendix A, has labelled the school as indicative only. Affordability. I remain of the opinion that zoning of land to increase supply is the key method available within the district plan to deliver on affordability. In my view, the MPSUD places greater emphasis on this point. As discussed in my evidence, housing in Hawea is at the more affordable end of the spectrum, and therefore increasing zoning where it creates greater competition and supply in Hawea will positively contribute to affordability outcomes. I do not support the intervention of the nature Mr Barr has proposed in the form of rules within Chapter 27. In my opinion, these types of provisions will create inefficiencies and will only seek to disincentivise housing being delivered to the market. In my view, the strategic chapters of the plan do not support a method of this nature, and it is not apparent to me why such provisions would be recommended for this rezoning when I'm not aware that such provisions have been suggested and associated with other zonings proposed to date through the PDP. I note in this respect no Section 32 evaluation has been provided to support the proposed provisions. If there is a concern, the zoning of the site would mean an opportunity exists for the contribution to the Queensland Lakes Community Housing Trust required by the approved SHA to not be delivered. This is not the intention. To this extent, an offer was put to QRDC to provide a deed to ensure the delivery of the contribution to the Queensland Lakes Housing Trust in accordance with the SHA. This this offer was not accepted by the council. And then finally, updated plan provisions. I provided a track change version of the PDP provisions within my evidence, and Mr. Barr provided further changes to these provisions in his rebuttal. To assist, I've reviewed those changes and attached as Appendix B as an updated version of the provisions, providing for the matters discussed above, and also those provisions where I agree with the recommendations Mr. Barr has made. In this respect, the changes where I agree with Mr. Barr are shown in yellow highlight, and further changes to reflect those matters discussed in the summary are shown in red.
Thank you. Can we close this window?
Yeah.
We're getting enough fresh air.
Yes.
Williams, in terms of the offer of a deed, confirm your Mr. Hawking's intention. Ms. Baker Galloway would presumably have told you you don't need a counterparty for a deed. The Universal could have entered into a deed poll that was enforceable without the council's participation. Did you think about it?
Is that a question for me? Or
yep.
No, I guess I didn't, largely because the existing deed in respect of the SHA is with the council, and so I thought it would be tidy to provide for some extension of that or a similar type of approach, given if there is a concern, it's from the council.
Sorry, that was just something that occurred to me on the way by. Commissioner Hill.
I think a couple of questions from me, and a number of them have already been addressed really by the National Policy Act, will come to that. And just looking at your at this rewording, and it's actually Mr. Barr's rewording, and talking about this legible and strong urban edge, and we've talked a lot about that, given the NPS that's come out, do you still think it, you know, is a strong urban edge, or what we're referring to as a defensible urban edge, are they still relevant concepts? I mean, you've offered them here, and I don't think you're resiling from them, but to the extent, are you saying that they are necessary to make this rezoning proposal acceptable, and then overlay that against the new NPS, which basically, as we've heard from legal counsel and others, is talking about something much more, let's just get on and do it. And of course, if you want more, then you have to go through a whole other process through rezoning and do all the things. So how relevant are those concepts now, do you think?
Well, they're particularly relevant within the PDP, the strategic provisions around urban growth place a particular emphasis on defensible urban boundaries and providing for coordinated urban growth, as I see it, underpinning the notion of urban growth boundaries. There were no urban growth boundaries in the ODP. It's a new concept introduced by the PDP. Acknowledging that we now have a new NPS, but currently we have settled strategic objectives that place a particular emphasis on that, which has driven the...
Right.
In chapter four now, and chapter three.
So you just clarify, the 15 metre building restriction that you're suggesting now down domain, what's its purpose now? Is it simply an amenity?
It's to provide a more coordinated treatment to the boundary, both in terms of amenity, but also is it also helps to strengthen the defensibility of the boundary.
And hence, your view is in terms of the PDP, defensible boundary is still relevant, notwithstanding the NPS might be suggesting that it isn't. Well, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth.
I mean, I think the NPS, you know, provides not more support to the points where I was making my primary evidence about, you know, zoning more land, etc., and being receptive to proposals such as this, which are at scale. But nevertheless, we still have, you know, the PDP strategic objectives, and I think this proposal provides a good response. response that provides a balance between the two.
Right.
Yeah.
Just going to chapter four, the strategic, and looking at the specific Upper Clutha Basin specific policies, which talks about defining the growth boundaries of Lake Hauwea,
mm-hmm.
based on existing urbanised areas, or the second one, identify sufficient development potential for the planning period. Assume the planning period means the sort of the district plan life, and I suspect from what we've heard, this is taking a longer view. Is there do you see any inconsistency in terms of that provision?
Which policy was it?
This is 4.2.2.22b.
I think that's the policy that has. You're referring to 4.2.1.4b?
No.
I'm looking in part
4.2.2.2.22
on your page 32.
It's not in the.
I just
not in the consent order because that only covers certain of the policies. It's
yeah.
in the main.
It's in the balance.
It's in the balance. Yeah.
That is presumably in the balance because it hasn't been changed.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean
yes. Sorry. Yeah. No. I found that one now. So what was it? Sorry. What was the question again? There? Oh, sorry, so what was the question?
Oh, I was really just asking, and I'll complete the whole question and then see, have community supporters expressed through a strategic community planning document? Just thinking about the proposal you put up, is it your view that what you're professionally supporting lines up with those broader strategic provisions?
Yes, I do.
Because?
Because I think in terms of the efficiency of that... supply, I think we've identified there are shortcomings in the modelled approach that's been taken. I think that's well articulated in terms of land banking and that we need to go beyond simply what the model would suggest is sufficient within the planning period. And then as far as expressed through strategic community planning processes, I mean, I take a view that the community is broader than simply the Hauwea Community Association and their views. The Upper Clutha community as a whole has clearly expressed the challenges of a limited supply, etc., and the importance of addressing that issue in terms of, you know, the escalating house prices, etc. And so I take a slightly more broad view in terms of coming to a conclusion in respect of that limb of the policy.
Mm-hmm. The only other question I got was around the affordability, which are the same questions I asked the other two witnesses, but your summary is very clear, so I understand your position on that, so nothing further. Thank you. I might come back later with specific questions on your rewording.
Mr. Williams, question about paragraph 35, rezoning the township to low density. You consider the extent to which the rezoning is just recognising the density of consented development rather than actually representing an upzoning on the ground?
Yes, I have. I think Ms Hampson's modelled capacity is of assistance in that respect as well, and demonstrating, in Council's opinion, quite a degree of additional capacity could be realised through infill. But the only area that I think this upzoning overlays as far as, you know, very recently completed development would be the Sentinel Park development, so that was rural residential in the ODP large lot urban stage one, but has been developed to a density of around 800, 600 square metres through consent.
Like, I'm looking at the, you said proposed zoning township to low density. I know that the scope for infill development in what was formerly the rural residential areas, get my directions right, east of Grandview Terrace.
Yes.
And is now a large lot. And I've forgotten whether it's A or B, but it's large lot residential.
Right.
But you're referring to the rezoning to low density.
Yes.
Where is that going to make a difference to what's on the ground in terms of, because you've got Timsfield, which is already just developed, Sentinel Park, which is just developed. So you said that Ms. Hampson's assuming or modelled more info. Where is it physically within the township?
So there's still an area of Timsfield that gets picked up through this.
There's still an area of
Timsfield that gets, so I think 20 hectares was rezoned through stage one from rural residential to low density. But the remaining undeveloped area of Timsfield, which was already zoned township, would arguably be, you know, your greenfields type development through the low density. Corocchio Rise is also owned by Rilla Ridge. That's located more east and on top of the Moraine Terrace. That's quite a large it's about 8 hectares or so of undeveloped township zone.
Okay, thank you. I tagged your paragraph 43, which is talking about the 2016 NPS. It's about encouraging flexibility and choice. Now, translating that into the 2020 NPS, is there a limit? I think Mr. Copeland would say closer you get to nirvana or perfect competition, the better. Universal's proposing quite a large area of rezoning. If, for taking a hypothetical, this proposal had proposed rezoning of all of the land between Cemetery Road and Hawea Flat, which is to say, as we've discussed, another 1.1 kilometres, would the NPS have required that be rezoned too? The NPS 2020?
Not necessarily, no. The new NPS certainly is directive in requiring councils to be responsive to proposals that provide for significant development. But I see as part of that it talks about well-functioning urban environments. It's a key objective of the new NPS UD. And again, that underpins the approach we've taken to the rezoning here, and that I see the opportunities to introduce your other elements in terms of employment, reserves along the water race, the opportunity for the potential school site, the commercial shops, etc., all add to that more well-functioning urban environment as part of that growth.
So is that the test? Is that what determines what's required and what's not? At the point when you say it wouldn't be well-functioning?
I think it would be an important element, but the district plan would also place consideration on landscape. I think the potential landscape.
Also based on?
Landscape.
ask you that question, but is there any material difference in the landscape between the southern end of this zone site and Hawea Flat to your mind?
Oh, not in a topographical sense, but landscape architects would have a view as to a change in landscape character of, you know, at a certain scale.
Paragraph 77, you're talking about alignment with the RPS. I started with A, in accordance with any future development strategy for the district. Can you point out to me what future development strategy this rezoning is consistent with?
As I understand, the council hasn't officially released its future development strategy. It's still to be... from our more recent meetings with council, there's a draft and it's nearly ready, but yeah, that seems to be published yet.
Quick question first. On the structure plan, there's a... Oh, maybe it's not... No, I'm getting muddled with my red and orange dashes. The red dashed line going all the way down beside the eastern side of the SHA, that's the urban growth boundary.
Yes,
that's not right. The cycleway.
No, that's right.
Okay,
yeah.
No, the cycleway loops through the water race and then around the base of the urban of the residential area and down Domain Road, but not. Where's the cycleway that currently goes through from Cemetery Road towards the school in the Domain?
Yeah. No, that's a good point, because I think there's been some misunderstanding from Mr. Rossiter in respect of that, in that these cycleways are additional cycleways that could be developed as part of the design of the building restriction areas, and the links support that. But there's no intention for these to replace the current route.
Which
to
is weird.
So it runs along...
Is
so
it along there?
It's on the northern side of Cemetery Road.
Unformed legal road.
That's right, and it crosses at the unformed legal road and then runs down the unformed legal road and then down
Domain Road.
Yeah.
So that would... I mean, that's an unformed legal road. It's council land.
Yep.
So whatever's on that would
that's
just
right.
stay there.
Yeah.
Yes. So
that is a good point, because I think Mr. Rossiter misunderstood or implied that these... were an alternative, and that's less direct. Well, that's not then.
No.
Yeah, there's no intention
okay.
to replace those. That
right.
would remain. Yeah. These are additional.
I can see how, if you're going to expand Hawea in terms of residential, I don't think anyone's disagreeing that this is the direction that you'd go in,
yes.
South of Cemetery Road. I mean, and it already is in terms of the SHA and the rural lifestyle zone or whatever sort of zone it is.
Rural residential,
yes. So it's just, the question really between all the parties is just how far and then what time frame, rather than whether this is the right direction. But for the industrial zone, and I know I keep coming back to this, sure, there may well be a question of needing some industrial zone at Hawea or in somewhere else other than all being at Wanaka. But isn't that what the future development strategy, which is just about to come out, should be looking at for the long term? In terms of business growth. And to what extent is just putting a zone across the bottom of the subdivision for, as Mr. Hocking said, pragmatic reasons, the best way to plan for industrial growth when we've got a future development strategy coming out, which presumably is looking at the long-term business industrial growth for the Wanaka and Hawea, Albert Town, Nugget area generally?
Yes, I'm sure it would look at that. But fundamentally, there's a few things that always arise in this district as far as industrial zoning, that it's very difficult to find new areas.
Yes,
due to landscape sensitivities, reverse sensitivities. Mm. But also, the opportunity to have an industrial zone that can be associated with the urban area, rather than what we're having to do effectively in the Wakatipu ward now is look for somewhat remote areas to fill the gap. You've got the scope resources one up on the side of the remarks, those sorts of things. So this is a really, really good opportunity to secure that now. And in my view, it's actually, you should be more liberal in that zoning because it's much harder to find it later. And so it's better to secure that now with more zoning than might be purported to be needed through the modelled side of things, because to try and find it later becomes much more difficult.
So irrespective of what the modelling says, we don't know what the latest modelling is going to say yet. If there are no costs to doing this, in other words, there's no necessarily any downside, which is what Mr. Copeland's been saying, and it's really advantageous to have someone offering industrial land,
yes.
Given that if the future development strategy comes out and says, well, we're going to need some more land, even if it's in 15 years' time, and we'd better start looking for some, it may well say, well, let's look for someone who's offering it. I mean, is it that difficult that the council needs to snatch at people offering industrial land, even if they haven't gone through a matrix assessment of all available options?
I don't think there is a huge amount of options available within our urban areas. I think some of my evidence touches on the current industrial zoning, and the greenfields capacity left in Wanaka is largely held by in the Tussock Rise, and then the proposed DIZ zoning on Willow Ridges land. And so in modelled output terms, it may represent a large amount, but the reality is it's being held by those two developers can have a significant impact on whether or not that's realised or at what rate. So,
but even if we accept that, and that that there's a possibility that there will be a need for more industrial land,
yes.
In the future, say that's accepted. I mean, it doesn't mean at some point in the future, and you need to start planning for that. Why this land? When we've got a future development strategy that's supposed to look at options and I mean, that's what they say they're going to be doing, is looking at options for different industrial locations all over the district and planning for them, and, you know, doing, you know, looking at the costs and benefits of different locations. Why should we accept this land as being something that sort of preempts the future development strategy?
Well, the NPS, the new NPSUD, places support for being responsive to proposals of this nature, including business or industrial.
Mm.
It also places an emphasis on those zonings or proposals that can contribute to a well-functioning urban environment. And again, in my opinion, providing an employment opportunity of this nature in Hawea will do that. Also, in my experience, it is logical to place industrial areas on the periphery of existing urban areas. Glenda Drive in Queenstown was once.
Anderson Road.
Ballantyne Road was once on the edge. And so it might seem unusual, but in my opinion, this is a logical place for that to go.
It's not so out of the left field to be, I suppose, undermining any sort of bigger picture planning that might go on for industrial in the Wanaka half of the district.
No, in my opinion, it's the opposite. It's a logical place for it to go. The access onto Domain Road makes sense as far as being able to have the heavier traffic using that way versus filtering through a residential area. Like I said, as far as urban form goes, it's quite logical to place industrial areas on that periphery. So I think that plus it also contributes positively to the growth of the township.
And it's not so big that it's going to undermine the uptake of land in Wanaka, for example.
No, and I guess from my urban design background, it concerns me that sometimes the predominant rationale for the size of an area is entirely a modelled output from The Economist, because that doesn't necessarily bear any relationship to an efficient subdivision design or urban type elements. And so that's why it's a mix of all of those things that has generated the proposed area, rather than in a modelled output suggesting, yes, 6.8 is the correct number versus 10.1. Because, in my opinion, you can't rely on those sorts of models to that extent.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. McClure. I'm just getting there, modelling by an economist not to be relied on. just, can I progress or transgress on the urban growth boundary? And your evidence in chief goes into a defensible urban growth boundary. I can take you to the specific point, but it's just a general. For good or for bad, the discussion on the urban growth boundary was gone through in stage one, was concluded, and the ink is far from dry on that particular stage. And here we are being suggested that this is a defensible urban growth boundary, which is a road and a cadastral boundary. So why is this, in your opinion, better than anything that's gone before?
Well, this is a planned and designed boundary. The
I
cemetery.
See the other one was too. But crack on.
That's not my opinion.
The
whole structure planned approach is to provide a coordinated and defensible boundary. The NPSUD also would give stronger direction to a consideration of this nature versus any concern about the ink just being dry on stage one. And there is already development south of Cemetery Road.
what a race feature. How do we reconcile a kid's bike lane and a body of water?
The width of that space, I mean, the water race itself is 4 or 5 metres wide. There's plenty of space within the corridor to, you know, provide a safe environment. Yet, you know, the water will be a really high amenity attribute of that space, you know, so it'll enhance people's use rather than detract from it.
And in the water race, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's effective in the summer, but in the winter, does it revert to being a swale, or is there a body of water running through it?
So when the irrigation isn't running, it's dry, but it has a gravelled bottom, and I anticipate that the subdivision process and the triggers there around the landscaping will allow it to be enhanced in a manner that can, you know, make a feature of the water when it's flowing, but when it's not, you know, it has more of a gravelly bottom type attribute to it, which will be still a very high amenity.
There's no intent to continue the water flowing continuously?
I don't think so. I mean, it hasn't been discussed. I mean, I think that will be quite an interesting feature of it coming and going, as far as the, you know, dynamicness of that, which will add to the interest.
Good luck talking to Contact Energy about providing an amenity value from its stored reservoir.
Stock up the koi carp, you know. Also, with regard to the roading, there's an indicative roading layout, and that was an indicative master plan that was part of Mr. Espy's evidence, and there's a roading layout here. What happens to the SHA lots that are, because I'm making the assumption that those roading connections will connect into the SHA.
So just so we're talking from the same plan, so there's a plan attached to my summary today.
Just the large A3 one.
Yeah.
And there's got black lines on it, which
A.
relates almost exactly to Mr. SB's indicative.
Got some lines through the middle of the lot.
But there's, which is the same. I mean, it's the same. It's essentially the same as the black dotted lines you're talking about.
Yep.
But they go through lots on the SHA.
Oh, sorry, I see what you're saying. No, so they were future-proof connections, so they're not actually residential lots within the subdivision. They were to future-proof future growth options.
And where those intersect the water race potentially, I'm assuming again, and please stop my assumption, but the road takes precedence over the cycleway. Or is it the cycleway takes precedence over the road?
Oh, I don't think we've worked that level of detail, but I think that would be, you know, quite an opportunity to express the bridge form over the river. The bridge near Village Green in Queenstown is, you know, quite a feature where it comes up and over the Horn Creek, for example. But that would be resolved, you know, positively in the detail.
And one final one is a pink section on the SHA on your Appendix A. I'm just wondering what that relates to. I can't see a key.
So that's the local corner shopping zone?
No, that's the hatch one.
Medium density.
Or the MD? Or
the medium density. Sorry, we're talking about this area here.
On the SHA example that you gave us, the E3 SHA example, there's one pink section.
Probably the stormwater, I mean the wastewater thing.
Oh, sorry. You talking about this?
This map?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the pump station for the wastewater system for the SHA.
Say again.
It's the pump station lot for the SHA, so that'll be vested in QODC as part of the SHA.
Maybe that could pump water for the... No, all good, that makes it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Williams. Ms. Baker Galloway, I have one question for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's been occurred to me during the course of the discussion.
My understanding is that everyone is proceeding on the basis that what has been worked out in the appeals mediation will, in the fullness of time, be presented to the court. This is for chapters 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is your opinion as to whether the urban development provisions need to be reopened in the light of the MPSUD?
Oh, are we never going to get there? very possibly, but whether that needs to be reopened or if it's a... Well, when you say reopened, there's
well,
two
well,
routes.
The orders haven't been made. So
no, they have been made.
Have they?
Yep, oh. Chapter 4 is resolved.
Oh.
Except for the club, which is, yeah, except for the out here.
Yeah, yes, except for the UGB appeal out here at Tauia.
Yeah.
Clark Fortune appeal, which is the mediation agreement attached to the legal submissions. In terms of what the actual objectives and policies will say, the agreement was finally reached at mediation and the consent order has issued.
So the consent order has issued?
Yes.
So it will just be as soon as practicable to be changed, or
yeah.
Whatever the wording is.
Imagine the environment court probably wants to finish the
soon as practical
appeals that haven't been resolved first in terms of what's as soon as practical. But the important issue is that the consent order has been issued.
Yes.
And so it is settled for the moment, at least.
Yes. The provisions are operative. Yep.
Thank you very much. I think you're losing the word operative in a loose sense.
Provisions are beyond challenge.
Yes, beyond challenge.
And have been approved by the Environment Court. Yeah.
Right. So thank you very much, Ms. Baker-Galloway. There were a couple of things that you were going to provide to us.
Yes.
Timescale? What can you commit to?
I can commit to the end of the week.
Wait for it.
Oh, yeah, so we'll figure out, we'll confirm the time frame for conferencing with Mr. Smith on those residual points. I can't recall off the top of my head when the council's closing is due
and
in terms of the bookend to work
it's
towards.
Like the first week of September.
Okay, so, yeah, so I'll confer with Mr. Carr and we'll reach out to Council for QRDC and say this has been suggested. But if their reply is due at the end of August, then we want... conferencing to occur over the next fortnight, if possible.
Well, as I say, I'm not sure that I'm suggesting conferencing, but I think something something less formal than Environment Court Code conferencing, but I think you need a quiet discussion.
Yes, yes.
But in terms of, as I haven't gone back and looked at my notes, you're going to provide me with some information like... It was like the relative sizes.
And I think Mr. Copeland sent that through to me as we were working.
So the end of the week seems evidently doable.
Yep.
So we'll say the end of the week for the stray pieces of information that we've asked for and you've offered to provide.
Yes. Yep. And then I'll communicate the feasible time frame for Mr. Carr and Mr. Smith to have an informal conversation.
Once you've caught up with Ms. Scott.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you very much for that. Thank you for the whole Universal team. Appreciate it. A somewhat long afternoon, but a profitable one.
Mm, well, thanks for your tenacity.
And we will adjourn the hearing until 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Cool, thank you.